Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 55. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This show is being released on Monday, December 7, 2009. My interview with today's guest was recorded on November 13, 2009. What is the importance of trees in mythology? Is there a connection between ancient goddess worship and the Tree of Knowledge? How do sacred trees tie in with the Kabbalah? How do entheogens like mushrooms play into the ancient religions of Europe? How do you free the public mind from mass control? Tonight my guest is Michael Tesarian. Born in Belfast, Ireland, he's an author, public speaker, historian, businessman, whose topics include religion, symbolism, sidereal astrology, mythology, and the occult, and, not to mention, Atlantis and the New World Order, amongst many other topics. His books include The Irish Origins of Civilization and Astrotheology. He's the producer of many DVDs, and we'll also be discussing which attacks against Michael are fact and which are fiction. I heard a couple of rumors that I thought I'd ask Michael directly and let him speak for himself. And John Marco Allegro's The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, as I mentioned over the last week, is now in print, but the hardback edition has been delayed for about a week and a half. I hope to begin shipping those this week, as they did not go out last week as originally hoped. And many of you that pre-ordered your soft cover copies should have already received those. Allegro's book was one of the most controversial books written in the last century, and it's back in print now for the first time in more than 25 years, so make sure you get your copy. This 40th anniversary edition is updated with a preface by me and a foreword by Judith Ann Brown and an addendum, Fungus Redivivus, by Professor Carl A.P. Ruck of Boston University. And he is the original founder of the field, or one of the original founders of the field of ethnomycology, and also the inventor of the word entheogen. And both he and Judy have been on this show. And it also looks like I may be giving a presentation at the Living Temple Bookstore in Huntington Beach at the end of this month. More details are to follow in the coming weeks. Upcoming shows. Next week, I'm going to change things up a little bit. I'm going to have Peter Lavenda on to discuss his work in Sinister Forces, The Nine, and Gordon Wasson. This is a powerful interview that you won't want to miss, and I've also got a bunch of other great interviews lined up, including James Orrick, who will be on to discuss his book Tryptamine Palace on 5-MeO-DMT, also Stephen Zarlinga from the American Monetary Institute, and Josh Homan will be on to discuss ayahuasca in Peru and his new studies there, as well as Robert Forty, the author of Entheogens and the Future of Religion, and Steve Bayer, author of Singing to the Plants. And I apologize to Steve. I had planned to have him on a couple of months ago and things got mixed up. And now I've been busy getting book projects done and I have not had a chance to finish Steve's book, and I need to get that done as soon as possible and get him interviewed. And I also plan to have John Taylor Gatto on the show soon to further delve into education and the trivium. I haven't spoken to him yet, but I'm assuming that I will get him on the show. And I also plan to have Dr. Eric G. Wilson on, who has accepted to come on the show to discuss his book Against Happiness, which seems like a good follow-up to Barbara Ehrenreich's interview. And he sent me a copy of his book, which I hope to get in the next couple of days. So we'll check that out and possibly have him on. And over the next few weeks, I'm going to be playing the last of the interviews that are going to be going into the Entheogen book project. And we've gotten a lot of it finished. We're about halfway done with the edit process for most of the interviews already. And we do still need help transcribing the last few interviews that are being released over the next few weeks. So if you'd like to volunteer on that, we could greatly use your help just getting this stuff wrapped up. And as I mentioned over the last few weeks, Annie Arts is now on the store page on the Gnostic Media website with some Christmas crafts and solstice stuff, if you'd like to check that out. And also Kylie's handmade Amanita muscaria Christmas tree ornaments are up there as well. Those are very cool. She sent me a couple of those last year, and they are very nice. And I also forgot to mention last week that Iman has hooked us up on the cafe press page from the Gnostic Media store page on the website with a couple of new t-shirt and Christmas card designs. There is a very cool one up there that says, which would Jesus do, that has a picture of Jesus from the Canterbury Anglo-Catalan Psalter from the 13th century standing over four mushrooms with his arms up, and underneath it says, which would Jesus do? It's a pretty funny shirt, so if you'd like to pick up one of those, it's sure to stir a conversation and hopefully a controversy wherever you wear it. And if you'd like to donate directly to Gnostic Media, please go to GnosticMedia.com and click on the donations button at the top of the website. Donations this week, my love and thanks goes out to Thomas, Randy, and Oscar, and this show is dedicated to you guys. Thank you so much for your help. And this week I do have to pay Podomatic a $250 hosting fee for the shows, and so we can still use everyone's help on donations to help cover this. If you could help on that, we would be very grateful. We've got some money in to help cover it, but we could still use some more donations to help us with that, especially during the holidays. This show is mostly run on donations. We are not corporate media, but independent media in the truest sense of the words. And by donating or ordering one of the books or DVDs on the website or the She Who Remembers audio archives, you help continue our programming. And without your help, we cease to be here. And we're still offering 25% off of most of the items on the Gnostic Media website, including the books, DVDs, and She Who Remembers audio archives. But this does not include the Allegro book. And you, if you order now, you can still get things in time for the holidays or any birthday gifts. Once again, that's except for John Allegro's The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. And like I said, that is shipping now. The softcover edition has already started shipping. And the hardcover, keeping my fingers crossed, will start shipping this week. And, of course, thanks to everyone who has ordered a book or DVD or anything off the website or made a donation. We thank you so much. And before I forget, the views expressed by the authors and guests of this program are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself or Gnostic Media. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support. And if you'd like to go to the website, that's GnosticMedia.com, GNOSTIC. media.com, and you can contact me directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Michael, welcome to Gnostic Media's podcast. How are you doing today?
Oh, very well, Jan. Thank you so much for the invitation. It's been a long time since I've been following your work, and appreciate everything you're doing. So it's just great that have an educated host, so to speak. It's always fine to be on interviews of that nature as opposed to the other brand.
Yeah, and I think that in this type of interview, we should be able to bounce back and forth off each other quite a bit. So, and I noticed that you and I do certainly seem to have a lot of overlap. I don't know if we necessarily agree or disagree in all areas. I haven't studied all of your work. I've seen probably 8 or 10 of your videos, and I've seen a few papers and articles that you've written, and I quoted you in my first book a couple of times, cited you there. But I really wanted to take this opportunity to dive more into work and find out more about who is Michael Sarian and what you're about. So if you would like to start off with that, why don't you dive in?
Okay, and again, big thanks to you, and I love your work and promoted it as much as I can, because it's not just the John Allegro material, but the whole framework of understanding our ancient roots is of vital importance, especially in today's world. People know me. I'm from Ireland, and I've written on Atlantis, the origins of evil, and astrotheology, and on the Irish origins of civilization, and people know me from these works. It's important, of course, that they realize that these are all connected works. They're not really different. Even the latest thing we're doing, Architects of Control, when we're linking conspiracy theory with psychology, all the things I do are basically, again, like your work in a way. It's looking at the larger map, the whole movement of this.
It all ties together, doesn't it?
Yeah, it all ties together. It's very syncretic. And So I don't look at just one area of my work as being divided or separate from another. Of course, my process began in Ireland, but during my years there, it was a little bit more focused on Irish mythology and a little bit to do with subversive symbolism. That's back in the early 80s. But by the time I got to America, there's a welter of great speakers, great teachers. And so I just immersed myself in their work and slowly, you know, going through the Eustace Mullinses and the G. Edward Griffins and the Dr. Stan Monteiths and, you know, Webster Tarpleys, what have you, start to put together the bigger picture. And I think what's happened is that a lot of people now in the time we're living, more human beings, more masses, not just in America, but throughout the world, are starting to realize that political events specifically are orchestrated and they do fit a certain design or agenda or purpose. The next few years will be more study for people. Those who do know it's an agenda have to rightly identify what that agenda is. And they're not going to be able to do that. I don't really think they've done it so far. We're quite a good long way. We've made great progress, but we're not fully there yet. Yeah, because there's still a lot of finger pointing, there's still a lot of myopia, there's still a lot of fundamentalistic perspectives. And this is, of course, I'm sure you've noticed that every little radio show, every little, you know, cabal, every little website, every speaker, they have their own little niche, and that's fine in the beginning. But I think that the hungry student, this is what I get anyway, the feedback that comes to me, is that they're looking for that overarching agenda. And, you know, does it come from Babylon, like David Icke are saying? You know, is it the British government, like some are saying? Is it the Judaism? You know, is it the Jesuitism? Is it the Vatican? You know, people are investigating and looking at all of these different potentialities. And I think that's important because we do see a little bit too much myopia, too much fundamentalism. We also see people trying to territorialize certain aspects of this knowledge, and it can become a problem where a certain group, Christian or other, tries to step in and say, no, we have the whole truth here, we know what's going on, and if you even mention Guido von Liszt or Madame Blavatsky or Aleister Crowley or Alfred Rosenberg or whoever, you know, especially in my work I mentioned a wide variety of scholars from all different fields, suddenly they think they've got the number on you, you know, this kind of thing. So there's even dangers. I mean, it sounds crazy to say it, but there's even dangers that when you begin the investigation and you do it publicly, you're already going to be lambasted, and you're already going to be, you know, targeted by a bunch of people who, you know, are label reading and have this particular prejudicial perspective. And I say to those people that if you have that prejudicial perspective, you are never in a month of Sundays ever going to work out what's going on in the world.
Exactly. No, and you know, and my point is that even if somebody is a racist or whatever they may be, does that somehow negate or make invalid every single bit of research they ever did?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, to explain what my point of view is, that if you are a racist or a racialist, I want to hear from you. I want to hear from the Malcolm X's. I don't mind listening to Muhammad Ali ranting on some sort of, you know, interview. I don't mind listening to, you know, Elijah Muhammad. I don't mind listening to David Duke. I want to hear from all the points of view. I want to get my arms around all that information because there's elements of truth in all of it. But as I say, people invade this particular research community with dragging all their baggage with them, not realizing that the moment that you step into the world of conspiracy or alternative research, you are in an occult sphere of knowledge, whether you like it or not. So bringing all your, you know, prejudicial baggage with you is the most counterproductive thing that can happen, and it will not last. It will not last. We have to listen to and study all the different angles of this incredible hybrid, and that's basically what my focus was, and I did that. I did as the Romans do. When I came to America, I didn't bring my, you know, little prejudices with me. I left them at the door and tried to look into all sorts of areas, New Age and other, Christian. You know, in fact, I keep telling this to people who have talked to me from the Christian movement. I mean, I'd say that 80% of the original researchers that I studied, and many of them even in Ireland, were Christian.
You're cutting out just a little bit. You said original research were Christian?
Yeah, the original researchers I studied and those who had the biggest influence on me, and many of them who were even personal mentors, such as Professor Tolkien and Professor Lewis and also
Professor,
you know, George MacDonald.
You cut out again. Professor who?
Lewis. C.S. Lewis.
Okay.
Yeah, these individuals were, for me, extraordinary in the way that they spoke about history and the world. And even though they came from a particular mindset, you know, they didn't let that limit their overall understanding of the matrix of power. So again, I encourage a lot of people to do that. And I'm seeing that, again, as I said before, there's people are now waking up. I say there's a huge demographic of people right now all across the world who do understand that everything they see on the news, everything they read in the newspapers, is, especially in the, as I say, in the political milieu, is orchestrated. It has an agenda. The next few years is just going to be people to sift through the information, do their homework, and find out what agenda. You know, of course, I come from the point of view that it started in Atlantis, moved through Egypt. I call the conspiracy an Atenist conspiracy. And that's okay. People can, you know, read up what I've done and see if that makes sense to them. Or they can just stick with what they, you know, want to believe, where there's, you know, neo-Nazi or neocon or, you know, democon or whatever they're looking at. There's a process of understanding. There's a relationship with knowledge. It's not just about gaining the knowledge. It's actually about having a relationship with the knowledge and also being very skeptical about what we read and what we see, and forming people have to form their own conclusions. But it, to me, it's absolutely a spiritual work. It's absolutely eclectic. It could be bigger than all of us even know. And we are in an era, in a, literally a time frame, a generation where is unique in the history of the world, because our forefathers, even one generation ago, couldn't ask these questions, didn't ask these questions. And the few who did, including the John Allegros and others like him, were, you know, assassinated professionally, and their works have been suppressed. So I have no time, zero tolerance for those people, you know, who come along with this very, very territorialistic and negative attitude towards this kind of research. I never lose sight of the time that we're in and how precious it is.
It seems to me that just from hearing your words, have you heard of the Trivium?
No.
That would be
not outside the Roman terminology.
Okay. Well, we'll have to talk about that. We'll have to make another discussion of that sometime. I did a show on the Trivium recently that you might be interested in.
I'd love to listen to that.
Yeah. What triggered you to begin studying the ancient mysteries in the first place? I heard something about you were at a protest or something in Ireland, and something caught your eye and things went from there.
No. What happened was that I think that it started because family members, people within my family, including my mother, were very much involved with the New Age movement. So I was sort of plunged in to meet a lot of key figures in that movement. And as time developed, you know, I really studied them. I would always describe my life, whether it's with my Eastern side of family and their whole, you know, Sikhism, or whether it's with my father and his communism and his Marxism, whether it's with my mother and her New Age, connections. These people always were out to teach me, or teach the, you know, their followers or whatever. I was learning, but the trouble was that I was learning a lot more than they wanted to teach. Being very objective and highly critical, I would learn things that in the end would separate me from what they were doing. And some of these people were close. They were, you know, practically family. And I had, through the years, we're talking about a 20-year, you know, apprenticeship in a way. And I started to see with my own senses, my own eyes, my own experience, that reality was actually the opposite in many cases of what they were talking about. I guess it was more perceptible when I was hanging around with my father and listening to him, because his was a strictly Marxist, communistic, he would call it humanistic, background. And we were brought up to despise capitalism and to despise all conservatives. And he did talk a lot about the Jewish conspiracy at points, but he had very limited knowledge of it. If you had ever pointed out anything conspiratorial to him, he would have completely negated it, or said that it's not a conspiracy, it's just a lot of greedy, materialistic, corporate, you know, imperialistic types of people. He would have given the usual communistic left-wing rhetoric. And, of course, my own experience started to realize that this was total bunkum, because as G. Edward Griffin has pointed out, how come all the leading communists are basically some of the wealthiest people in the world? That's number one. And number two, how is it that Stalin and Trotsky and Lenin are some of the world's worst psychopathic murderers, and Mao Zedong and Ho Chi Minh and all his great heroes, including Marshal Tito, all the people that he lionized, you know, were mass murderers? And when you read up their biographies, then I noticed that he had myopia. So it started in those days that to contradict what my even closest relatives were believing in can leave you in a wilderness. But what it does is it helps you to realize that, look, if you expose one or two falsehoods with these people, big, big, big ones, why believe the rest of what they're talking about? And, you know, my father, for instance, all the days of his life used to have a bust of Lenin on his mantelpiece. I mean, this is an Irish man. He was non-violent in the sense that his struggle and his objective was, of course, it was non-violence. He didn't believe in, he didn't sympathize with the Republican IRA or anything like that. He didn't believe that killing was the solution. He wanted to work strictly within a political framework. But basically, the rhetoric and the kinds of philosophical ideas, let's point to another one. And I never could bring this up to him because he was the kind of person who would not listen to anything that contradicted him. He's very opinionated. But for instance, say I had, for instance, played devil's advocate and told him that how come it is that the real author of Das Kapital, the real author of the Communist Manifesto, Friedrich Engels, was not only a wealthy, super wealthy Jewish financier or industrialist in the north of England who had children down his mines. He actually had industries and he had mines and all sorts of cotton industries and what have you. This is meant to be the arch communist, literally the co-author of Das Kapital, if you will, one of the leading communists that all the commies look up to, was actually an incredibly, you know, capitalistic person who children were dying in the mines working for his corporations in the north of England. This is absolutely, you know, provable. Again, things like that you could never bring up, not to mention the campaign of genocide that took place in Russia and so forth and so on. So it was a really good way for me. And these are just a few examples. I've got examples of that right across the board with my mother's New Age connections and friends.
Oh,
and,
well, you know, and the whole New Age thing, talking about humanist a minute ago, that ties in through Theosophy and the whole positive thinking movement, which is, I think, mind control.
And it's very much all of these organizations which started off as sects that were mostly, as you say, theosophical or religious, let's say, or pan-religious, slowly, slowly, slowly they were infiltrated and they were made into political organizations. This is what happened with Theosophy. It's eventually what happened with other movements like Rudolf Steiner's organizations. Not originally, I don't believe these were originally anything to do with politics. That can be proven. They were actually just research institutions and they, you know, had a little bit of religion and theosophy tied into it and what have you. And I think that was quite benign. But slowly, these things again became politicized. They were infiltrated because I have a belief, you see, that all the control establishment, the Black Lodge at the highest level, is extremely frightened of any kind of philosophical or theological freedom, in the sense that even a group that teaches man to look to his own selfhood, look to his own individual morality, they're actually scared of that. They want institutionalized religions. And if they find a particular sect or even a particular religion that looks like it's not going to go there, they will try to institutionalize it or they'll try to completely control it and destroy it. And so this also has to be borne in mind. I'm not a fan of those people who have just, you know, a tar brush for all of these different organizations, because I've studied them. A lot of the people who debunk these organizations haven't bothered to really read or study their works. I have.
Have you?
And I know how these.
I was going to ask you, have you come across a book that came out recently by Barbara Ehrenreich, and I'm going to be interviewing her probably next week. But she's got a new book out called Bright Sided that goes into a lot of this material. Have you seen that yet?
No, that's, again, sounds fascinating.
It's a phenomenal read. I highly recommend that, and I'm very excited to get her on the show here as soon as possible as well. So anyway, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, I mean, just concluding, I would say that in my background, it became quite obvious then that there's an answer to all these contradictions. I knew the questions. And like I say, after I spent some time in America studying it, then I started to find the answers. The pieces of the jigsaw started to come together until I realized basically what I realize now. And that is, I don't care what you call yourself, a jihadist, an Islamist, a Zionist, a Nazi, a fascist, a communist. Basically, these are all heads of the Hydra that are connected to a single demonic, you know, entity, a single demonic intelligence. I also must say, though, that I'm not a Christian, you know, and I do have huge problems with religion, Orthodox official religion. I think that they're custom made for psychopaths, and my work, you know, looks into proving that. I think they're kindergartens for psychopathy. I've mentioned that, and I've even stated clearly the reasons why. And part of it is because they're based on hierarchy, like the different Masonic lodges. And therefore, I've learned certain metaphysical truisms and certain metaphysical rules of thumb that you can use. One of them is that if you see any entity or organization that is hierarchical in its nature, you should start being worried at that point. Because all the original Aryan, and I hope we get a chance to define what that word really means, and also the Druidic organizations were not hierarchical. And most of the organizations, be they religious or corporate, that you see today are strictly hierarchical. And my mind goes back to even the pretty recent book by Joel Bakan, The Corporation, in which he clearly defines corporations as psychopathic, meaning more specifically that the people who invent them and create them and fund them and work in these corporations, they themselves are psychopathic. Obviously, a corporation can't be. He meant the intelligences, the human intelligences, put these together. And slowly people are waking up to this, that there's nothing healthy about these organizations and corporations. But the thing is that those organizations, including all the financial and economic organizations that plague the world today, are strictly hierarchical. And that alone is the definition, the hallmark of, you know, dementia. And these are then fallible because ultimately they have an end by date. They're not part of civilization, neither are the religions. I believe that the people who are working in religion, you know, who tell us to not use our reason and just believe and have faith, this is what drives civilization into the ground. This is what stops civilization. So just as some great, I think it was Thomas Paine, who said that wherever there is a government in the world, you can be sure that there is no freedom. And he said that he's basically implying that governments and all these institutions are the bane of civilization. So when you hear these terms like civilization bandied around, you know, it's debatable whether we even have one, because the pestilence that exists in man, his own toxic emotions, his vision of the world, his disconnect from nature, all of these things manifest in physical forms in the external world. The governments are part of it. They're part of the manifestation of a man's own inner temperament, which is not healthy. It's not in a good state.
I like how James DeMeo defined civilization in his book, Saharasia, which was defined as the civil treatment of others.
It's beautiful, and I'm a big fan of his work. I was so glad to hear and listen to the interview that you did with him, because I've been into Wilhelm Reich's work since I was a child and love Saharasia. I mention it in my DVD series. He's got some very powerful points there. It was a wonderful interview. I hope that people go and listen to him, because he's one of the great teachers of our age, and especially go from even DeMeo's work straight into Wilhelm Reich, because Reich for me was a real huge mentor, in the sense that he always, always, always pointed out the connections between the psychology of man and his environment. Now, of course, for Reich, even biology was psychology. The absolute beauty of his work was that he said that the body physical is an extension of your consciousness. And of course, the church doesn't like that, because immediately as you go down that road, then you're talking about the freedom of the body, how the body needs to be in this the relationship between consciousness and the human body is also one of the areas that's so toxic today. And of course, the churches and all the religions are key in this. They have helped man to believe in the suppression of nature, the suppression of his natural instincts and his body. And so the Wilhelm Reichs of the world are, you know, lethal to their, you know, their mechanisms of control, because he tries to show us that really the body is the temple of God and is an extension of your psychology. But DeMeo and their work, people really should know about it. It's absolutely key, that some of the key philosophies there to help people understand what's going on in the world and also to take their power back. But again, coming back to Thomas Paine, I mean, you know, the more perfect a civilization is, the less reason it will have for a government. And the converse then tells you what's going on. If you see these governments, and I don't care what kind of governments they are, these edifices will take the power away. And that's what they're designed to do. They're designed to keep man in a totally primitive, uncivilized state. You can never have civilization while these organizations exist. They're actually retroactive.
Would you mind telling us a little bit about the mystery schools and what they were involved in?
Well, of course, there's many. And I would say that most of them were corrupt. So those people who are a bit suspicious of many of the mystery schools, especially those of the modern age, you know, they have a point. I'm not negating that. I'm just saying that when you start researching these things, it's important to be able to see what was positive about it and what also got corrupted. The original mystery schools, of course, those who existed on the Nile, those that existed perhaps in Chaldea and Babylon and so forth, these were always put together by the Stellar cult, which is basically the oldest religious institution in the world. And that was their big thing, of course, was astrology. And their other important subject that they taught was geomancy, that the earth was a living being and that you were an extension of the earth. So the key of what they taught in the mystery schools was very powerful. And it was about that. Imagine, you know, you've heard a lot of talk of auras, of course, and even John Vallow Melchizedek and others of his ilk talk about the Merkaba, the human Merkaba. Well, what the ancient mystery schools were teaching is that the self of a man and nature are connected. Nature is really the aura, if you will, of man's selfhood. So when man is looking for his selfhood, he's actually staring at it every day and doesn't realize it. It's like the line from Tennyson's poem.
It's like the microcosm and the macrocosm. And since you mentioned Drunvalno, then I guess you might as well go, you know, not forget to mention the tree of life and the flower of life as well.
Yeah. Yes, the seed of life, the tree of life. This is why they used a lot of organic vegetal symbolism. And that's originally why even Druidic mystery schools were outdoors. The Druids never had their colleges of learning indoors. They always had it outdoors so that you could see the trees, you could feel the elements, and you could observe the stars. They were the starry temples of old. And of course, we have a mystery school today, which is the church. And even though the Protestant religion has tried to sanitize their version of the religion in order to sort of downsize its, downplay its pagan elements, no matter how you sanitize it, it won't work, because obviously there's pagan elements, and there's even works coming out every single month proving this, you know, that even there's Judaic religion is not free of its pagan elements. It all links back to either Egyptian paganism or to Druidic paganism, and there's nothing that can be done about that.
There's a very good book tying, just like Allegro pointed out in The Sacred Mushroom of the Cross, tying all of Judaism's history back into the ancient fertility cults. It was written in 1967 by a guy, Alan Edwardis, and it's called Erotica Judaica, and it's a fantastic book for looking at, you know, like Yahweh is the ancient phallic god and the suppression of the female goddess cultures and things like that, which is exactly what we're about to get into here.
Yeah, and anyone who doubts this can do the homework. Don't believe what we're saying. Go and look at the edifices. Go and look at the mosaics. Go look at the architecture. Look at the meanings of the words, like we're saying, and start to understand that these new sort of quote-unquote mystery schools, their modus operandi, of course, is different. To be specific, the fraternity structures within schools and the military, the fraternity structure within the seminaries, the fraternity systems within the secret orders and secret societies have a reason for that hierarchical structure. And it's the reverse of what the Druids used to do, which is they are filtering out good men. They're filtering out moral men. In the place of virtue and morality, they'll give you status, money, wealth, and power. But behind those people, you see, is the rot, the toxicity or the obsession of basically what I believe is a sort of an alien proclivity. But without even getting into that, just keeping it in layman's context, we just see that the tremendous hypocrisy and non-virtue that is happening there, because these organizations and the structure is there to gut it. And secondly, they have a second function, which is to prevent good men from rising. Good men will obviously join. And that's why I don't like bashing these organizations, because that's far, far too limited in understanding. Good men might be, for whatever reason, attracted to theosophy, attracted to masonry, as a good man is often attracted to Christianity or religion. But what they don't realize until it's often too late, and many of the case histories of Freemasonry prove this to be the point. We have whistleblowers from within inside who will tell you exactly what went on and confirm exactly what I'm saying, which is that they didn't make any progress. And it's just like the same story in a corporation. You try to bunk the system or bring true morality in there, and you'll soon find that they've given you your marching orders. And Ron Paul, he said it. He says, when one gets into bed with government, you better expect the diseases that it spreads. And he's absolutely right. And so the big questions of the age that we're living in right now is, how do we dispense? Because a lot of people go, hey, Michael, what about the solutions? You know, let's talk about solutions as if I never mentioned solutions. My work is full of solutions, but you still get these people who haven't read your work telling you that you haven't given them any solutions. Then I turn around to them, as I did recently, and say, look, isn't the solution the same as identifying the problem and removing it? So if my work or anybody's work who works in this field is helping you to identify the problem or problems, that is the solution. But again, people want you to, you know, install it in their brain, which is the same colonialization, the same victimhood that we're finding in the world. You know, so they turn to us as if we're going to sort of install something or lead them or be their teachers or gurus or whatever. And yet the whole message is to free yourself from the chains of this kind of allegiance. And it seems that, you know, people have a great difficulty with that. But, you know, it's like T.S. Eliot said, a man, you know, humankind can't bear very much reality. And I'd say that you were asking about how I got into this and my experience. I'd say now, after, because I started about 1982, after all these years, I basically have really understood deeply what T.S. Eliot was talking about. Man cannot bear much reality. It's simply not something he can handle. He has his ideas. He has his ideas of reality, but he's not able to really deal too much with reality as it really is. And we have to be very, very aware of that, that man is infirm. He's fragmentary. He gets very anxious. He's not really capable of really understanding, you know, the way things work in the world.
I think, though, at the same time, that in some way that is intentional, which I mentioned the trivium back towards the beginning of the show, when the powers that be are intentionally withholding the trivium and the quadrivium and the several seven liberal arts from people's education, they create this inability for people to not be able to deal with these things. And then they can go and point at the person and say, look, you know, see, they're incapable of dealing with it. Somebody gave me the analogy. It's like you break the front legs of a sheep, and then you blame the sheep, or you kick the sheep because it can't stand up, right?
Yeah. It's part of the design to disempower you. It starts as early as the school years, in which your own natural flow of intelligence is, you know, subverted, and that you start to then rely on the authority figures who are only too happy to basically not only be sadistic towards you, but to teach you self-sadism. They know that you're going to be angry when you work out the truth. They know that you're going to be angry when you find out how much you've been lied to. So they have very clever ways of helping you to interject that anger. And this goes to the heart of a lot of my work on psychology, is that the person is walking around basically policing themselves. And as David Icke said, we police each other then. We become each person's own jailer. And this is another part of this that has to always be borne in mind. But, you know, just take even, I don't know, an example is that, you know, the Catholic confession. What kind of a criminal are, it's like, this is incredible. You think the tiger is going to lead you out of the jungle? How much craziness is there to go to one of the most criminal institutions in the world only to tell them your little personal domestic, you know, crimes and misdemeanors? And it's well known in an Irish context, of course, that many of the actual priests are not only in league with the provisional IRA, but are often commanders of the IRA. This is, again, a one street level anecdote I can bring up. But even outside of that fact, the very idea that you can go to somebody and sit in a box and tell them that you've, you know, committed murder or what have you, and then say, oh, well, you know, you're absolute, say a couple of Hail Marys and, you know, bugger off, and that's meant to take care of it.
No jail time and no nothing, just go into that confession box.
It's incredible, isn't it? I mean, people will lament today that even the worst serial killers sitting on death row only have to mumble a little bit of contrition, and suddenly the entire Christian, you know, clergy and nuns and all of these different charitable organizations that are Christian-based descend upon them to talk about how they're now going to be free and liberated be compassionate to them and what have you. And, you know, no compassion for the victims. It's like these people can just mumble a few words and suddenly they, you know, converted. It becomes a tremendous market, an incredible joke almost, you know. And again, within all of these religions and within the mystery schools is the seed of truth. but the seed has been perverted or misinterpreted. It has to be there. If it's not there, they can't lure you, because they know that subconsciously man wants the truth. So by using the iconography, very mystical iconography, I might add, by using certain talismanic words, and by the promise. I talk about this in Volume 2 of the Irish Origins. I have a whole chapter on this idea of the promise, that the authority figure above you, be he Constantine, be he God, be he whoever, you know, is going to promise you a future paradise or whatever, and then people get into lockstep. There's also, like you implied earlier on, that there's a reason for why people will dumb themselves down, why they'll be, you know, blindly obedient and so forth and so on. They're being given a certain glowing promise, and under that guise, they will literally murder your enemies for you and do all sorts of other atrocities in the world. What they won't do is they won't question where all of that iconography comes from. You know, they talk about being born again. You know, where does that term come from? Don't they know that that was a key part of the Druidic mysteries about dying and being born again? Even when you talk about the alchemy and the chemical wedding implies that you have to have a chemical divorce, in which you have to die to all the things of the world, be renamed, rebaptized, and reborn again. Or they'll talk about, you know, Yahweh and Elohim, without even knowing where these words came from, that they represent trees and they represent ancient sacred cults. And they represent the feminine principle. Both those words end with a feminine suffix, and therefore are feminine in nature. And yet God is always portrayed as a man, you know. So when you start opening the ball of wax, then the truth, of course, will come out. But it's, of course, as we have always pointed out, you know, truth is very threatening to those people who have an idea of reality and to which they hold on with grim death. What we're seeing now, and one can use even astrological parlance by talking about the presence of Pluto or perhaps even the Age of Awakening, the Maya theory, whatever you want to put at it. But basically, outside all of the rhetoric, what it really means is that we are in an Age of Awakening in which those particular ideas of reality and those particular prejudices are going to be shaken up, whether you like it or not. That's what's happening. And so there will be a dividing of the sheep from the goats, of those people who really, really can live for truth and discover the preciousness of freedom, and those people who just simply will not be able to get it, and who will run towards the controllers saying, give us your global village, give us that authority, give us that stability and security. You know, I think it was, I can't remember exactly who said it, but I think it was a French philosopher who said that, you know, tyranny is always much better organized than freedom. And there's great wisdom behind that, because again, it has that orderliness. And the man who doesn't want to be free, or the man who's looking for freedom from freedom, will literally run to be an inhabitant of that incarceration, be it cyber or some other kind. They've done it all through the years. They've done it through the millennium. And what they don't realize is that it's the most toxic and disorganized people who keep on bleeding about, you know, new world order. They're the most disgustingly disorganized people when it comes to morals and also spirituality. And therefore, they talk about, it's like a man who's lost the power of his legs. He requires the braces, which are artificial in nature and are stapled on from outside. Man psychologically is doing exactly the same thing. He's looking for those crutches. And it's unbelievable to watch that process.
That's a good analogy. And what amazes me is that people will finally escape the clutches of the traditional dogmatic churches and then fall right into the new age, which is really, I see that as a second sort of catch web that has been set up to really keep people from breaking free of these religious dogmas. It sort of goes from, okay, well, if you're not going to believe in these religions, then what we're going to do is condition you to only think positive, and then anybody who brings up any type of critical thinking or analyzation or anything is considered negative and therefore should be dismissed.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And that was from my personal living experience. It's very much part of the criticism that I had of these people who were involved with the New Age. Not every one of them. I had other criticisms.
Oh, no, definitely not all of them. But, you know, in fact, I've living out here near Los Angeles, I see it all the time. And in fact, I recently a friend of mine said that he told me that I was too negative and that I should only be positive. And he gave me one of these positive New Age books and told me that because I was critically thinking, basically, that he didn't want to be friends anymore. So, you know, I see this stuff, and it's really sad to see people get sucked into these cults and to not think for themselves and to not investigate and look deeper into them.
It goes up the fractal, exact same philosophy. For instance, I talk a lot about psychology in my work. Obviously it's very weak, but it's a sort of a street level knee-jerk reaction to psychology is, hey man, what do you want to talk about all this Freudianism? Okay, we got garbage in the mind, but I don't want to go and sort through garbage. So this became a sort of a trite type of rebuttal.
Right.
Against why did the psychology? And my answer to that, of course, is because it's your garbage.
Right. And not only that, but you dig through that garbage and, you know, one man's trash is another man's treasure, and you might find something that really enlightens you, that one little bit of information, that one little gold nugget or whatever it may be that puts you into the next level of understanding because you were just open to it.
But look at the disassociation in the person who would literally believe that the content of their own consciousness, number one, is garbage. That's worrisome enough. And two, that you don't need to bother sorting it out. I mean, it's almost playing right into the hands of the psychologist who could easily turn back to them and say, my goodness, you don't know that parts of yourself, even though they're repressed and even though they're denied, those are parts of your selfhood. They're in your own mental attic. And you're going to tell me that that stink and that reek? But you know why people believe that? Is because of exactly what you said. The whole New Age movement has been designed to give us this gimmickry and give us these bogus belief systems and spinner rack self-helpism in order to completely subvert a man's true inwardness and his true search for selfhood. It's remarkable when you look at how sophisticated it is. And that, again, took, you know, at least 10 years for me to work out. And again, I had to have my nose in it. It's because I had my nose in it that I finally smelt a rat and realized, yeah, this isn't as great as they make out. I even had close proximity to organizations which censored. They actually censored and vetoed work. For instance, they would carry a certain amount of books, for instance. And then you'd try to say, you know, can I order these books or where do you get these books? And they go, oh, I'm sorry, we don't allow those books. And there you have it. They would state that they were private organizations and they had the right to literally circumscribe their work and only present those works to their followers or their, you know, members that they wanted. So immediately I was like out of there. It's like, oh, do me a favor. Here we have a form of fascism and totalitarianism under the guise of incense and yoga and all sorts of other rubbish, you see. And this is very much the case, in, as you well know, in California, where you'll go into bookstores and they're already aligned with a certain path or a certain belief system.
Oh, certainly.
And you'd be damned if you can find anything else in there. They'll even take it off the shelves. And when I was very active, like trying to, I used to, you know, spend nights and nights and nights photocopying chapters of books and stapling them together and all sorts of anecdotes, you know, on just 8x11s. And I would go and try and put them on the boards of these various bookstores and even grocery stores and health food stores. And I started to, I was very overjoyed because I'd go back the next day and they were all taken. So I thought, hey, you know, this is wonderful. People are really taking our material here. And this was just a wide eclectic variety of, you know, photocopies of people's books and very important hard out of print works. This is sort of, you know, what I was doing in the early days, in the early 90s. And one day I was leaving this very big grocery store. It was in the Bay Area. And I was walking out and I just happened to glance at the trash cans that they had, one of which was, of course, the recycling bin. And I saw popping out of it, you know, one of these newspapers that we had sort of, you know, laid out in the area where they're already telling you you can lay out all sorts of flyers and you can lay out all of this different literature. So I went over to this trash can and said, you know, oh, gee, you know, what's this doing there? And when I opened it, all of our stuff had been dumped there. All of the week's different stuff that we had brought, you know, 2-3 days that week, was in a giant pile thrown away. And then it dawned on me, you see, that this wasn't some individual doing this. This was the staff of this particular business had done this, meaning they knew we were coming, they had gone through our stuff, and they had taken it and dumped it. So much for freedom in California, you know, so much for, you know, the free world, you know. All of our hard work, all of our expenses, you know, hours and hours and hours up at Kinko's at night at our own expense, you know. In those days, Kinko's used to give you a discount if you went in the night. So we were literally there sometimes 6 hours of the night, willfully and happily, creating this stuff, and we start to realize that these stores, plural, were throwing our stuff away. They didn't even want it there. And a lot of this was even on the American patriotism. A lot of it was on, you know, sort of against Desert Storm or what, I can't remember exactly what, but a lot of important things, you know, that Americans needed to know. And there it was being methodically taken and dumped. And it was one of the most heartbreaking things in those days, you know, to wake up to see that this kind of censorship and blatant, you know, blatant sort of totalitarianistic attitudes was going on, you know.
Yeah, I do, unfortunately.
Point is, you bring a bunch of highfalutin, New Age paraphernalia in pink font, and it'll be there till the cows come home, you know. Any type of rubbish that's being taught on some other pie-in-the-sky, you know, razzmatazz, you know, if Jesus, they'll want to frame it for you.
That's funny. Well, let's change gears for a minute. You wrote an article called Trees of Life. What are you getting into in this research?
That is basically a part, a very important part of the Irish Origins of Civilization volumes. The volumes, you know, got about 600 pictures in them. There's a double volume. And the thing is like a brick, you know. It's like I don't know how many thousands of pages is in there. It's like at least 1,000 pages it became. And so unfortunately, a lot of the research that I had, you know, couldn't fit. Not even as written text appendices, you know, usually appendices are attached to the end of the book. And we tried that, and it was unbelievable. The thing was just too voluminous. So I ended up having to put them online. They're free online, all the appendices. They're basically an extension of the book. And the Tree of Life was an extension of, I believe, Chapter 10, which is called Druids, the Priestarchy of the World. And the leftover materials then became this other, basically, book, you know, but it's online, free of charge. It's called The Trees of Life. People go to the Irish Origins of Civilization website, click on appendices, and they'll see it. There's an appendices number 8. And that was to really get into greater depth about what the Druids actually believed. But as people will see from even the very first picture on the page and from the first captions, this druidic symbolism, Jan, was, you know, I've always noticed it turning up in government, not just in the edifices of the architecture, but literally inside the Oval Office, inside the corridors of power. People are coming, getting up to speed now on this, you know, with the various websites and books talking about the secret architecture of the Masons in Washington, D.C. There's even more blockbusters on the way, I believe.
Oh, right. Well, the entire Washington, D.C. area is based on the Kabbalic Tree of Life.
Yeah. And, you know, I have a colleague right now in Belgium who's been inspired by my work. He has it's unbelievable. If you go to his blog called Belgian Illuminati, I have the link on my symbolism page on the forum. So people go to the Michael Tessarian forum, the MSAR forum, go to the symbolism page, and you'll see my colleague's blog spot. It's called Belgian Illuminati. He has actually overhead photographs of the Kabbalistic Tree of Life in the cities of Belgium, exactly as you're saying, exists in America. And of course, this is in other cities of the world too. And I'm glad to see that people are getting up to speed on this. But what they're not really understanding is when they're pointing and they're even showing pictures of these things is the floral symbolism. Why on earth would the caps and the uniforms and the regalia, especially of the Vatican and other cities of the world, like we're saying, what is all of this vegetal floral motifs doing? A person like me comes along and writes a book on Druids and says, hey, it's, you know, Christianity, Judeo-Christianity, Masonry, Templarism, Rosicrucianism. It's all based on ancient Druidism. And they laugh at you. Well, I can prove it. And one of the most important avenues to this proof is involving this particular vegetal type of symbolism. Now, of course, it goes much, much deeper than just what I'm saying now. This goes into the whole denigration of the female, because you can't think about plants and flowers without thinking about the female. I mean, just the names of women, you know, it will show you just how connected
right.
they are, their dress, their particular costumes down through the ages.
Well, not to mention the flower is the sexual organ of the plant.
Yeah, exactly. The sexual symbolism that's involved there, the religious, spiritual, like Mother Mary is always shown with the lily or the apple. And so I encourage people to go and check out that appendices, and they'll see a lot of pictures there. And don't worry, it's not going to become a book. A lot of people have said you should make that into a book. It's not going to happen. This is a perfect thesis just to be as an appendices to the book I've already written. But it is wonderful. It's really fascinating. And this will also open up a lot of doors, because it explains not only, well, it basically confirms the thesis that these modern institutions of power are directly based on Druidism and the old Aryan teachings and philosophies. And it ties in, you see, with the female and the denigration of the female. This is one of the reasons why the clergy, both from the Protestant and Catholic religions, always dress in those flowing robes. This has been pointed out by many scholars that they do this. And pictures of the Pope there, you see, with his floral decor, his regalia, and even the crozier, and all sorts of symbolism that's attached to these religions. It comes from these Druidic motifs. I also have excerpts from several movies, Solomon and Sheba, The Ten Commandments, The Da Vinci Code, and other movies. I've got screenshots there with analyses of that to show how even in the movies, both modern and a little bit older, are also doing this. They're also drawing heavily on the Tree of Life Kabbalistic symbolism and on the Seed of Life and these various other fascinating, you know, why do we call a department of a government office a branch, for instance, you know, like the branch? Why do we call a group of personnel a staff? You know, where do these terms come from? Right. Why do we see a lot of floral motifs in the architecture and what have you? There's reasons for this. There's so much of this Druidism around us that, again, it's about decoding it and using the right keys to unlock the reasons for all of this. The Lord Mayor, you know, the people know that the word mayor, where that comes from, it's the same as the word major, M-A-Y-O-R or M-A-J-O-R, and how that connects to the yew trees, or how the name Jehovah and Elohim, which are the two names of God in the Bible, are directly, I mean directly linked. And of course, anyone who reads the Bible with educated eyes will notice the prevalence of trees. And there's not just the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. There's in the Genesis, they talk about the oak tree, that there's actually an oak tree in the book of Genesis.
It's right, and Genesis. Abraham has his visions under the oak as well.
Is that right? I didn't know that. Abraham?
I think Abraham receives the oracle under the oak. I believe it's Abraham. I'll have to look into that. I think it's in my first book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, but I'll have to look.
Well, I mean, we do have the famous anecdote of Eve and Adam standing beside the so-called trees. We have Moses in front of his famous burning bush. I mean, people, you know, could stop there. Just stop right there. Or why is it that there's an olive grove in the Garden of Gethsemane that bears 12 kinds of fruit? You know, this is where Jesus, in Gethsemane Hill, where he went to the night before his crucifixion. There's information in the book of Revelations about this and the strange tree there that grows the 12 fruits. Well, the Kabbalah tree, which has 10 fruits, so to speak, 10 circles, some traditions have it with 11. And some,
and then that would be with the da'at, and then so then what would be the 12th one? Would it be the tree of death, or where would they place the 12th position on that?
I believe that there used to be even one zone higher than Kether.
Okay.
Yeah, but again, different traditions, some have even only had 7. And see, don't forget, in some Kabbalistic teachings, the first three, that's Kether, Chokhmah, and Bina, are considered one Sephirah. They're called the supernal triangle. And some traditions have that as being one level of intelligence, and under which are 7 other circles, 7 other Sephiroth, and those are then corresponding to the 7 chakras. So people who are interested in connecting the Kabbalistic systems with the Vedic system might find something interesting there, that if you consider the first three in the supernal triangle to be one Sephiroth, then you have 7, which then are meant to, you know, correspond with the 7 chakras. So
the Kabbalistic and the 7 liberal arts as well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. 7 notes of the scale and what have you.
Exactly.
All sorts of tie-ins right there. 7 gods. There's so many pantheons that have the 7 gods.
7 planets, 7 this, 7 that.
Oh, there's even traditions. I think it's one right out of the Sefer Yetzirah itself, where Bina was the head of the tree. In the earliest days, before they even developed the concept of the 10, there were certain, let's just call them for convenience sake right now, Jewish traditions, that actually had Bina, which is the feminine principle, how interesting that is, as the top Sephirah. They didn't even have Chokhmah and Kether higher than that. So that's quite interesting as well. But you have also this story in Genesis 35. There's an oak tree in Genesis, and the prophet, whoever it is, Joseph or whatever, is told by God to go and take the idols of the pagans, right? All these people are about to be converted, which means slaughtered. Take all of their icons, the false gods, and bury them under an oak tree. So we even have a third tree that's never mentioned, you know, turning up in the book of Genesis. And then the olive grove and the fig tree. It's unbelievable, you know, how many actually Druidic, if people get my book on astrotheology, the very first chapter goes into how many passages of the Bible actually relate directly to solar cultism, stellar cultism, and plain old basic Druidism straight off the bat there, you know.
So why is ancient goddess worship important to tree worship?
Well, that's the big issue there. And of course, there's so many, many reasons for that. One of the most important was actually reasons strikes at the root of the book of Genesis. In the, as we know now from people like Lawrence Gardner and many others before him, that the, and of course, not to mention John Allegro and scholars of that type of academic level, obviously they've discovered that the book of Genesis was a retelling of earlier stories, like the Gilgamesh and what have you, and all the Babylonian, the Garden of Eden and what have you. So it's basically accepted now that the book of Genesis is a direct plagiarism of the old Sumerian, Babylonian, Akkadian stories. Ralph Ellis has pointed out beautifully in one of his latest books that there's an Egyptian tie-in there, that the very story of Garden of Eden pertains right to Akhenaten himself. So without getting into detail about that, all he's saying is that it does predate the dates of the Bible being written. And in those stories, especially the Babylonian and the Akkadian and Sumerian, which I think are identical to the Druidic, by the way, so in my reading of history, there's no difference between these groups. But in their reading of the Genesis story, a fascinating piece of information comes out, and it's written in the appendices there. And that is that in the Bible, God is the tree. God speaks through the tree, or at least in the old mythologies, God is identified with the tree. He speaks from the tree. The tree is his personal property. He's forbidding the primal parents from going anywhere near it. But in the original stories, what do you know? Eve is the tree. The female either is the tree or the female's consort. That means sexual partner, marriage partner, husband, if you will, is the tree. So what does this do then, see, to the Genesis story in Christianity when you take Eve or Lilith or whoever from this temptress type character who's the despoiler and who's in league with the evil one and actually make her, the, if not the voice of God, but because, again, the tree was always identified with God in ancient times before the Bible, you know, destroyed the story or mutilated the story. Or she is the consort of the tree. The next question then is, who is Adam? Well, in the Bible, Adam is the firstborn of God. He's literally the God-to-be. He's going to be the being that's going to be before the sin, before the fall. He is literally God's chosen one, the one who's going to go into the world, you know, and name the animals and own the creation. But in the original story, the Adam figure is born from the woman. In fact, the Adam character is the offspring of the female and the God.
Yeah, and in fact, if you read the Nag Hammadi text on the origins of the world, that is discussed there, and we republished that in Astrotheology and Shamanism, at least the part of that about Adam being born from Eve, or from Eve, and then Sophia comes down and banishes the seven landlords out of Eden.
That's right. I do remember that. I do remember that part, and it pertains very much to this. So, this is provable. This is directly provable because the original stories, and that also explains all the different iconography and these palm sets and these cuneiform tablets that they've discovered, is why the female is always seen in proximity to the tree. The fact of the matter is that the tree represented the unnameable figure of the higher intelligence. So even those who believe in a god, or that the ancients believed in a god, the symbol of their god was the tree, various trees. That's why Elohim means tree. It's the elm tree specifically. That's why Yahweh, Jehovah, represents a tree, specifically the yew tree. That's why Moses meets God at a burning bush. That's why all the symbolism, I even have symbolism of the Scottish church. The Church of Scotland literally has a symbol. Their symbol is the burning tree, right? It actually looks like a mushroom, actually, and it's inside the vagina-shaped vesica. Because, again, these potentates and priests of the higher Masonic levels know exactly what we're talking about here, that we're trying to reveal. And that is that the female was actually the original oracle. students of even general mythology will know.
Well,
this,
Adonis was born from a tree, and so that would make sense, because if the goddess is the tree, that would explain how the god is born from the tree.
And simple common sense tells us that men are born from women, not the other way around. So this finally fits with even common sense biology all of a sudden. Hey, guess what? But this is in Akkadian, the Assyrians, and of course, we're forgetting to talk about the serpent. But even leaving the serpent aside, because again, the serpent played an important role in this.
You mean the Caduceus, right?
Sure, exactly. Because remember, the tree of life often you can see a serpent on it. Egypt was referred to as the land of the tree and the serpent. In the Babylonian stela, you always see the symbol of the serpent. The serpent meant wisdom, of course. But the hieroglyphic for the female in Egyptian was a serpent, as it was in other cultures too. So the serpent was just another analogy or simulacra, not only for any female, though. This has to be borne in mind. It's what I refer to as the sacerdotal female, or the sacred priestly female, the one who is the initiator. She turns up in the Bible, of course, as Mary Magdalene, who literally anoints Jesus, which is an Egyptian ritual, and initiates him with the myrrh. Excuse me, the spikenard. You had mentioned that Adonis was born from a tree. His mother's name was Myrrh, from which we get the myrrh tree. And some scholars interpret it as myrtle, so it doesn't really matter. Myrtle and myrrh, the whole idea connect. And this even goes back to Isis and Nephthys, all being connected to certain trees, especially the goddess Nuth, which I spent a lot of time writing about in the appendices, is connected to the tree. But it turns up as Mary Magdalene in the Book of Genesis, and my reading of that is this, not in the Book of Genesis, but in the New Testament, my reading of that anointing is not only that it was an Egyptian ritual in order to sanctify Christ, to make him into the Messiah, the true meaning of that word, but when you anointed a man with an oil that was abstracted from a plant, in this case spikenard, what you were doing was turning that man into the spikenard. It's really that simple, and it's so beautiful if you actually think about it. Other people think the anointing's incidental, and it's what it means or is going to mean, etc. No, the very anointing of a human being with an oil of a certain plant was to identify that man with that plant. And then this goes even further when you find out that the name spikenard, the plant, actually comes from the genus nard, N-A-R-D, spikenard, comes from the genus nard, and that is the origin of the word Notrex, which is the opening portico of a church. When you first walk inside a church, they have a certain lobby, if you want to call it that.
Right.
That's called a narthex. And that's where the holy books and even the holy water is kept before you actually enter into the precinct, you know, where the nave is and all the rest of it. Well, that is actually named after the spikenard plant and the genus nard. Right down, as I said, to the costumes, right down to the shape of the chalice, which, of course, you've gone into extensively in your work, how that connects to the sacred mushroom. And in my work, I also believe that we've just been talking about the tree of life. The tree of life also includes the mushroom. Not only is the tree, as we know it, connected to the female or identical to the female, the mushroom itself was the original burning bush. There's many mushrooms that even have an orangey, very bright, almost like a torch. So bright.
Yeah, the Amanita muscaria ranges from yellow to bright scarlet red.
And
of course these mushrooms grow in symbiotic relationship with specific types of trees, and especially the trees that are found sacred in ancient mythology, such as the pine, the birch, the fir, the oak, and there's a few others. And in fact, I've even found Amanita muscaria growing at the base of an apple tree with Amanita on the ground next to fallen red apples. So I didn't miss the opportunity to take some pictures of that.
God, that's insane.
Yeah, you know, and as we show in Astrotheology and Shamanism, the symbol of the caduceus is the symbol of modern medicine and drugs. You know, the two serpents is typically representative of thieves and merchants and bankers and things like that. But the one with one serpent was originally the symbol of drugs and medicine. And not only does it represent the Kabbalic tree of life, fertility, because the serpent is both male and female in ways, which is represented if it's either straight or curved in the depictions where it's used, but that serpent wrapped around the tree of life On top of all of those things and a few others is the symbol of drugs itself. That is the caduceus, the symbol of medicine and drugs today.
Yes, and there's no doubt about it. I'm not negating the fact that the rites of the pagans did deeply involve the sexual rites. There's no doubt about that. The very word kohen, which is the Hebrew word for priest, literally means guardian of the semen.
That doesn't surprise me. I didn't know that, but maybe I did know that, but that does not surprise me at all.
It's interesting too, because the semen, of course, the spermatozoon, is actually serpent-like.
Right.
So it wriggles like a little worm or a little serpent. So there's a whole tie-in there with even the microscopic analyses of the male spermatozoon connecting to all of this.
We actually talked about that in our first book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, the tie between the sperm and the serpent and this stuff.
It's difficult for people to grasp, of course, because we're taught not to think in iconic or symbolic forms anymore, but it's amazing to discover that the mushroom with the red head is literally analogized in iconography as the red-headed woman, who is either Mary or Mary Magdalene or who have you. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of the Egyptian women did dye their hair. I believe a lot of them were redheads to begin with. That ties into the whole West-East movement. But just even the dyeing of the hair to be red was to simulate. Because remember, there is this topic of the the sacred harlot or the sacred prostitute, and these were women who were always attached to priestarchies and to temple precincts, and they would, of course, not only be involved in very specific, important rites which involve some sexual symbolism, but they also just performed even lower level sexual, roles for the priests, and they were known as the Herodulae, they were known as the sacred prostitutes. And they would often go and take their mates under trees in groves. So there was also a whole aspect to this that people nowadays would look at as being profane. But of course, that's the prejudice of our own age. In those days, it wasn't considered that at all. So they would even copulate under the trees, amongst these mushrooms, and be on them as well. Let's not doubt for a moment. And therefore, in some sort of like hallucinogenic fit.
You mean these mushrooms that look like phallics and that represent both male and female genital parts while they're having intercourse on them?
Yeah.
Really?
That's part of it. And more importantly is that then what happened is because it was so much part of the feminine rites, sexual rites, somehow a tie-in happened where the female herself, they were actually even called virgins, amazingly enough, because of course the term being that if you weren't married to the man, you could still, in mythological terms, or ritualistic terms, be still referred to as a virgin. These were women who were attached to the ancient cults of the ancient world, and they satisfied the needs of the priests and of the kings of the time. And somehow some weird tie-in happened. I guess you got to be on the stuff for this to happen. I don't know, but the tie-in took place where the mushroom literally not only was phallic, as we know it was, it also became a symbol of the woman herself. And certainly the artists picked up on this in their iconography. So basically, as you'll see, people go to the appendices, they'll see pictures of this. Whenever you see the red-headed female, and I don't care if it's in the work of Signorelli or Caravaggio or even earlier, like Raphael and Botticelli, of course, this striking figure of the red-headed sacerdotal female is actually a simulacra, literally stands for the tree of life or the mushroom of life. They're identical. And then, of course, if you rewind, and go back to the story of Moses meeting God, quote-unquote, at the tree of life, this burning bush, suddenly an interesting story starts to awaken. Not only that the name Jehovah is feminine, but that the tree of life that he meets Yahweh at is also a symbol of the sacerdotal female. So this really, puts a new sheen on things, and I believe it's the true story. It actually explains things greatly, and it's one of the reasons why the Bible was written in this kind of code. And it's one of the reasons, to answer your original question, why the church, you see, have gone out of their way to suppress the female right across the board, and also to get us away from what they would call pagan, or profane tropes and elements of these ancient ways, is because they have co-opted it. They dress as the female. They dress as the sacred mushroom. I mean, the little hat, the yarmulke thing that they put on their heads and all that.
Oh, yeah. We brought a lot of attention to that in both our book and video.
There you go. And the halo. Some halos are actually designed to look like a horizontally placed you know, underside of a Anomita muscaria. So,
representing the gills, etc.
Mm-hmm. And don't forget the tarot plays a role in this, because studying the tarot helps to decode the Bible. For instance, card number 2, the high priestess, is literally, not only is she sitting in front of two pillars, or between two pillars, which is Kabbalistic, but behind her you even have a 10-fruited tree of life, the pomegranate tree, sacred to Persephone, sacred to the goddesses of the underworld. And of course there's a syzygy involved. She's both the sacred female, but she's also the sexual, erotic high priestess who initiates man, you know, as the pagans did. The sacerdotal female, or one of her wards, always initiated the man into his sexuality and into deeper mysteries as well. So it's not just as simple as genital sexuality. It's an initiation into the portal, into the true mysteries of nature, and which include the mysteries of man himself. The fact that this was done with drugs, you know, people can draw their own conclusions whether they think that is reprehensible or not. I actually personally do think it's reprehensible. I have no time for that stuff myself. But again, as a student of these things, you know, we have to leave those prejudices aside. And the point being that this is how they did things. And in a way, it's no different than what's being done today. The cult that is posing, the cult that's hiding behind, you know, Vatican religion today, is no less involved in these things. They just keep it very quiet, as we know.
All right. What are the 3 columns in the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, and how do they tie into this?
Well, of course, again, there's different schools, but generally in Kabbalism, you have the 3 pillars. One is known as the Pillar of Mercy. The other one's the Pillar of Severity. And the most fascinating pillar is the central one, which is the Pillar of Equilibrium, or the Pillar of Balance. This identifies it with the goddess Maat, because the name Maat, which is the goddess, M-A-A-T, she was connected to straightness. The interpretation of her name, there's many levels of meaning. One is just mother. Another one is a balance, an equilibrium. Another one is straightness. That's why you'll always see the goddess Maat behind the pharaoh with her hand up, almost like she's guiding him to walk straight. We see her effigy today on courtrooms. Lady Justice is nothing but a Grecianized version of Lady Maat. And fascinatingly, and to me, she represents that central column. And this can be proven, because again, by the tarot and by Kabbalah. If you get out a detailed image, and there's plenty of these online, a detailed image of the Tree of Life with the different paths. The 22 paths of the Tree of Life correspond not only to the 22 letters of the so-called Hebrew alphabet, but they also connect directly to the 22 cards of the major arcana. And if you go and look at a diagram where it literally shows you the names of the cards on the 22 paths of the Tree of Life, you'll notice something really fascinating, and that is that the middle column, all the paths are female cards. I believe it's Empress, High Priestess, and Temperance, and Universe. 4 paths, and all the cards that fit there are the feminine cards of the tarot. People who are into tarot will know this. Others need to go and look at it. But this then confirms the whole point, that card number 2 of the tarot is already, as an iconograph, is already showing you this. And there's other cards that do this as well. But the central column is basically the feminine mysteries. And feminine is not exactly the same thing as female. We need to bring that out as well. The feminine can include the male, because there's masculine women and there's feminine men. The feminine path, when we're talking mystical terms or metaphysical schools of thought, doesn't just involve the female as we know that. It's a different kind of reading of that, and it represents nature originally. Another fascinating aspect that it represents is, as we said, certain cards of the tarot, certain signs of the zodiac, and much more importantly, one of the most important features of the zodiac is the circumpolar region, which is where the pole points. There's a region of space up there that is been sacred for many, many, many thousands of years, going back to the earliest dawn of time, basically, to the stellar cult. They were fascinated by the movement of the pole through the 7 stations of the north, and it's Cancer is one of the highest constellations. So this circumpolar region is quite near Cancer. It's above Cancer, and it contains Ursa Major, Ursa Minor, and it contains one of the most important constellations of the stellar cult, which is Draco, the dragon, or the serpent. And there's this is where the Masonic G comes in, because one of the symbolisms of the Masonic G is this encircling serpent. I've pointed out in my works on Atlantis that the lowercase g is a serpentine in shape, and even the capitalized G, even though it's more disguised, still represents the serpent. and it represents a specific serpent. It's the heavenly serpent of Draco, which was the symbol of royalty. That's why the pharaoh is always seen with the crown of Uraeus, the serpent. That's what the word Messiah actually means. It came from a word meaning Messa, which was specifically the oil or the fat of the crocodile god and the crocodile of the Nile that all the pharaohs and dignitaries and priests were initiated in. First of all, they were initiated a lot of times by women, which is this tie-in again. Second of all, it wasn't that there was something that mystical about the Nile crocodile. It was a symbol, because the Nile crocodile was the earliest iconograph of Draco. So before Draco even became a more traditional-looking serpent, the original symbol, and you can see this if you go to the zodiacs of Dendera and the other earliest zodiacs in the world, Draco is actually a crocodile. And this is why the pharaoh then was initiated in the fat of the crocodile. It was all astrotheological, all astrological in nature, to point out that the pharaoh, or the leader of the people, the highest king, the pharaoh's nous, the enlightened mind, was an astrologer. He had mastered the secrets of the stars. He was a master astrologer, master mathematician. And most importantly, he was now identified with this ring of space. And it's literally a ring. It's called the circumpolar zone or the circumpolar region, which was consecrated to the sacred female. And the pharaoh then, by becoming her child, when he's initiated into his, you know, enlightenment or whatever, he then becomes known as the son of Egypt, or the son of Nuth, or the son of Mat, or the son of Ta'urt. And in fact, going back to the tarot again, the earliest derivation of the word tarot is this goddess Ta'urt, or Ta'urt, who was the hippopotamus god of the circumpolar region. And all the later artists, many pieces of architecture and statuary, St. Peter's Square, for instance, all of these circular plazas that you see all over the world are actually based on this. Halos were also based on this. They're not just based on the sun. They're mostly based on this idea of the circumpolar region. And the interesting thing is that over in Ireland, the Druids had exactly the same ritual. And it's one of the strongest proofs that I have, not the only one, but one of the strongest proofs I have, not only of the West to East connections, but that when I talk about the Amonists of Egypt being identical to the Druids, it's this serpentine symbolism and this crowning of the pharaoh based on the constellation of Draco that is one of the strongest proofs. And in fact, across the board, wherever you see the protecting serpent, the serpent coiling, the Chinese dragon dances, I don't care where it turns up, it's not about a physical serpent, it's about the stellar cult and the constellation of Draco. But since the circumpolar region was consecrated to the divine female, this is where originally the symbolism came from. This is originally where all of this feminine sacred symbolism came from.
Pretty fascinating.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Talk about two things, and then we'll go into another topic from there. Let's discuss unicorns and the Star of David.
Right. Unicorn. One of the, we mentioned briefly there, the sign of Cancer. Cancer is the most northerly sign. In fact, a lot of people associate Leo with the sun, because astrologically speaking, the sun is the ruler of the sign of Leo. But as a matter of fact, from a true astronomical point of view, the sun reaches its highest point in the zodiac in Cancer. And so Cancer in ancient times was considered the royal house of the sun. Not only that, but because it's a lunar house, when the sun moves into Cancer, then you have what is called the chemical wedding, which is another occult principle, very, very important in ancient times. But before the crab was given as the symbol of Cancer, and let's not forget that America is also born under Cancer, so there's tremendous symbolism in that, but it was the scarab beetle that was the ancient symbol of Cancer. But in Anglo-Saxon countries outside of Egypt, it was the unicorn. The pale white unicorn represented the moon. And that's why you see on heraldry the unicorn on one side and the red lion on the other. It's astrological. The unicorn representing Cancer and the lion representing Leo. So all royal insignias, all heraldry is absolutely astrotheological. It's absolutely sidereal in nature. Now, so when you see the symbol of the unicorn turning up, and it also turns up in religious art, you'll often see, and people can go to the Tree of Life appendices, and they'll see pictures of Mother Mary holding a little unicorn. And it's astrological in nature, because again, Cancer being close to the circumpolar region. In fact, for all we know, the horn of the unicorn may have even represented the pole itself. So this is another thing to be looked into. But all these different iconic animals, like the four animals that surround the cradle of Jesus, representing the four cardinal points
Right.
Is patently astrological, you see, in those days. And the other one was what did you mention?
The Star of David.
Oh, this is unbelievable, yeah. It's basically, so much can be said about that. It is a sexual symbol in one level because it represents the masculine, you know, upward-pointing triangle merging with the downward-pointing one.
Right.
It is astrological because, after all, there's six northern signs and six southern signs, or let's say three stations of the sun in the northern arch and three stations of the sun in its underworld journey, so it's astrological also.
Not to mention, let's not forget geometric and the mathematical.
Oh, yeah. That's right, because a three-dimensional Star of David actually makes a cube, and we see that the cube turns up in the throne of the pharaoh. The pharaoh sits on a square cuboid throne.
Not to mention masonry and everything else, right?
Yeah, the ashlar of masonry, that's right, is connected to this cube. Really interesting about the angles of the cube and all of these relative symbols. Or you can look at it the other way. When you open a cube up, sometimes in school they do this, you open up a cube into its planes, and what does it make? A perfect Latin cross. And that means that the cross, the Star of David, and the cube of the pharaoh all represent the same mystery school tradition. It's just three branches, and this is why I was talking earlier. You know, we started off by talking about the idiotic prejudices that these people have, imagining in their wildest dreams that there's really a difference between all of this. Jesus on the cross, the Star of David, the pharaoh with his arms crossed across his chest, sitting on the cube. It's all the crucified man. It's all the quartering that's being talked about. But in context of what we've been speaking about, the very word David, again, just like we talked about earlier, going into what some of these words mean, the very word David is actually a far better translation of the hieroglyphics of T-U-T. And T-U-T is obviously found in names like Tutmosis and in Tutankhamun. You also find the T-U-T as the tutors, the Teutons, the teachers. There's a lot of this phraseology of T-U-T. And it turns out, and this is the most recent up-to-date research that's been done on the hieroglyphics and the Egyptian language, it's now been discovered that that was a very poor translation. The T's, and I actually believe this was totally conscious, they did it on purpose. They mistranslated those hieroglyphics. The closer English word is D, not T. And another fact that needs to be borne in mind is that hieroglyphics can be read from left to right or from right to left. I don't want to go into further explanations because it'll just be a digression, but just bear that in mind. Now, the T-U-T is actually D-U-D. And the U, the hieroglyphic from which U was taken, can also be a V. So D-V-D is actually a closer translation. And you find this in Wales under the name David, or David, which was sacred to the Druids and became the name David. It turns up in the word dividing, which is why you have a compass and rule motif in Freemasonry, because they're the dividers. It turns up in the word dove. All these are derivations. Now, I don't mean, as a linguist, who's basically an exoteric scholar, would understand it. We're not talking exoteric, you know, academia here. We're talking about the esoteric permutations and connotations of these terms. This also has to be borne in mind, because you get a lot of people emailing you having the faintest idea that they've entered into an occult world. They're still trying to say, well, wait a minute, you know, the dictionary doesn't say that. Yeah, well,
right.
Then
well,
who wrote
you know,
the dictionary?
Some people will, and I've, you know, etymology is a tricky area, and, you know, some of them are speculation and some of them are valid, and it's just, you know, it's an overall comparison. And, you know, I've definitely heard people criticize some of your etymologies and things like that. And I've seen maybe one or two that I looked into and I couldn't find evidence for it. But then I've seen others that over the years I've found a lot of evidence for. And it's just, you know, you have to take it in with... all of these things are really looked at through the ancient mystery schools on many different levels, you know, seven levels probably at least, I would assume.
True. And also, I agree with you. It's not an exact science, but then no science is exact. This is another myth that people are laboring under. Don't they know that official science has to be rolled over every 5 years and half of it chucked out? So again, this prejudice is ridiculous. And many of the people who critique me, the last person that they actually contact is me.
Right.
They go to my work, right? And then they see something that doesn't make sense or whatever, and that's brilliant. I'm glad it doesn't make sense. I'm the first person to say, check it out. and I have the sources. But, you know, 5 years later, after they've gone through all this palaver, you know, it gets back to me, and I say, and then I give them the answer, and then they're silent like the grave, you know. Why don't they get in contact with me first, and then I can we can debate it as civilized human beings, you know? And I'm willing to accept I'm wrong. I'm always updating my stuff.
I always tell people to contact the authors first if they have questions instead of attacking. And, you know, and generally, and this is a generalization, but generally people will attack the work before they've even read it. And,
That's right.
You know, so that's it's usually much more rare that people attack your work after reading it. But then, you know, if they have things about it after they've read it, then just contact the author directly. And I've been in that habit for many years of just contacting the authors directly with my questions. And that's, you know, because being a writer myself, I understand the importance of that and finding out directly from them their answer, and then you can base your decision from that directly.
Exactly. And that's what I love is when, you know, people, and there are, of course, people who do this, and then we share the sources and they go off and they, and you know something? Half of those people come back with even greater insights. A great deal of the work that I've done,
yeah, exactly,
is from contributions of people, you know, either putting me right on a particular thing gracefully and humanly and respectfully, understanding that nobody's trying to territorialize the knowledge here. But you see, you have this other group of people who, every time they open their mouth, they subtract from the, you know, the quotient of human knowledge. There are such people walking around. They're called idiots, and I will not, you know, waste my time in basically, you know, arguing with an idiot. That's ridiculous. I don't have the time for it physically, and it's madness because the idiot will never change. And as I said, part of the problem is that they have come into this knowledge dragging their academic baggage behind them. They're not privy to the authors and scholars that I've, you know, study, and that's partly understandable because a lot of it's out of print and hard to find and what have you. And they make these knee-jerk reactions based on the fact that they know that any type of esoteric knowledge, including those who teach it, they're a threat. They're a threat to all the ideas of reality that people have. So it's not really that they're reacting against me, which is why I don't take it personally. They're reacting against the power that truth has.
Well, and they'll throw out things like you're a Satanist or whatever. And I've seen actually somebody that you responded to very calmly and politely and handled it very well. And he was a fairly well-known researcher was calling you a Satanist because he buys into the literalness of the entire story.
Yeah, it happens. It really does. You know, and there's nothing I can do about that. I'm used to that kind of thing anyway. And again, I look at that as I pity them because it's their myopia. They're coming from that particular, you know, very fixed standpoint. And of course, that is part of the problem. This knowledge changes you. You see, it's not like jumping through hoops in the normal academic way to, you know, get a result. This is knowledge that ultimately changes you. And what I think is that people, they have this, they want you to be infallible. This is another, you know, foible that human nature has. When anyone stands up to be a teacher or healer or what have you, there's a certain need for that person to be totally infallible. When you show that you're just fallible, like everybody else, they can't stand it. And they want an authority to lead them, to tell them what's going on. They're willing to give, they're right 50% of the way because they go, look, I want to give up the authorities that I'm familiar with. But now that I want you as my authority, I want you to bear the same traits and to be, you know, identical in nature to the previous authorities. And that's ridiculous.
In this same line, somebody on a forum a couple weeks ago started this long 10-page thread about my credibility as a scholar because, one, he didn't think that any of the constellations were associated with gods, and two, that the word Philistine is not related to phallus. And instead, what he did was, when I said these things, and this guy claims to be studying etymology, or philology in college, but instead of listening to the sources that I provided on the show, he went on Wikipedia and then said it's not there and then started this huge 10-page thread about how I'm lying and misleading everybody and all this stuff. So what it came down to, though, is you know, I had to lead him through the whole process of learning how to critically think and actually fact-checked the sources that I provided. And one of the sources that I used was Biblical Archaeology Review. And what I had done, and speaking of, you know, being infallible, this person is expecting me to be infallible. And what I had did was I had made the grave mistake in this person's opinion of misstating it, where I said Philistine is related to the word phallus, but Philistines is actually related to the word uncircumcised. So it's uncircumcised phallus, not just phallus. And so that was my grave mistake, right? And this person, you know, went 10 pages into this, but if he had gone and I had provided even the exact issue of Biblical Archaeology Reviewed for them to look in, which was the December 2008 issue, they could have just looked right there. We would have all been on the same page, and then we could work from there. Oh, yeah, I did misstate that. You know, I had read it 5 months ago, and I couldn't, you know, it was just a Philistine or uncircumcised phallus versus phallus. I misstated it. So it's uncircumcised.
And then the same people, many of them who not only, as you say, come from the direct, strict academic world, and therefore I'm always dubious about what they think they know, but many of these people come from the religious world. I turn around, like I say, I never argue with idiots, and I don't. But what I would say to them in general is, why then haven't you worried about the 5,000 different translations of certain passages of the Bible and the countless thousand versions of not only the Latin Bible, but the, you know, the Greek, and then even into the Old Testament? How do you have time to spare contradicting some little guy like me when your own religion needs a thorough spring cleaning, you know? I mean, do you actually have time to spare? It boggles my mind. If these people imagine they have a penchant for this kind of criticism, then I can put them on to a lot of work. They'll never be lonely and they'll never be poor because I got lots of work for them. I can direct them to where they need to go to use those critical skills. Don't be fussing around with Michael Tesarian, you know.
Right. One of the topics that you bring up often in your research is the Arians. Would you like to discuss that?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, the first thing is, you know, the definition of the term. I can hardly think of a term that's been more misused and misapplied, although there are so many. But in my work of the last few years, it's been number one on the list. Basically, in a nutshell, it derives from the name of a goddess that either was A-R-I, Ari, or E-R-I, Ari. And this is where you find that word root in terms like terra, you know, like terra firma, the earth, and in Hiera, which is the top of the Greek pantheon. It just happens to have that. And even in words like Tara and Teri and Terra, you know, Terra, of course, being, you know, in the Bible, the so-called forefather. We have to understand that part of the propaganda was to masculinize the feminine, just like was done in the Bible. In Asherah, in Assyria, Syria, you know, all of these different terms bear her title. And the men of wisdom who worship the goddess, and she were just a personification of the stars and the sky, and also the earth, of course, they were known as the Aria. It represents, it's one of its secondary meanings is the west, the western islands or the western lands. It represents the pure ones, the noble ones. But most importantly, when you're dealing with the reinterpretation of that word, is to just completely emphasize that it has nothing to do with race. I think that solves the problem right there. And that all the squabbling for years has been basically, again, a product of little knowledge. Because as I said, as we were talking earlier, you know, etymology or whatever may not be a precise science, but that doesn't mean that we can't be extremely cognizant and reverent towards the secret meaning of words, in the sense that the words will betray a great deal of information. And words like we've already mentioned, David and the Tudors and the Toots, you know, this is legit. This is legitimate, and it opens up a great many doors. One of the things that it does, of course, is show that lots of things that we take as personal names, like Solomon, Jacob, David, Abraham, Joseph, Isaac, they're not actually names at all. They were titles. Specifically, the term David was the commander's name. The Tuts of Egypt, that prefix really meant that they were commanders of David. The David was a commander. In fact, they mentioned this in the Bible, that David's job was a commander. Not personal David as a man, but David would have been a title given to all commanders who were both priestly in one dimension of their role, and also, secondly, they were, you know, champions of the people and often military commanders or leaders. That was what a David was. It was never a personal name. And one of the great elements of deception, and I list many of these in Volume 2 of the Irish Origins book, is one of them is the turning of personal names into titles, and also then the turning of titles into personal names. It's incredible when you get into it. It's just one of the keys. And the word Arian, of course, the misapplication of that word goes even further. It's been so maligned. And the Arya originally were from the West, and that specifically means Britain and also Scandinavia. That's where the word Teutons comes from, Teutons, because the very elements that you find within the pantheon, cosmology, and religion of Egypt themselves, and this includes the building of the pyramid and the Sphinx, originated in the West. Scrolls were even found in Egypt that said that, in which the term Arya was used as the title, and again, not the name, but the title of the man who designed the pyramid. Part of that title was Ari, man of the Ari, and that was understood to be that he was a disciple of Horus, a Shamsu Hor, one of the, you know, the blue-eyed or green-eyed Westerners. So there's nothing bizarre about this at all, and in times to come, it'll be considered completely normal. Once they've dug up a few more tombs over there in China or whatever, a few more graves, even the academic world will just have to, you know, grit their teeth and bear it that, you know, white men from the West got into the East, and they're going to have to sink their teeth into the fact that they even brought many of the elements of culture. I'm not saying all of them. I'm not some, you know, extremist that says the East was primitive, and you know, men from the West brought every element of culture. But what I am saying is what the Eastern adepts say, right out of their own horse's mouth, that these were not invaders, as we put before us in these duplicitous history books. These were migrants. In fact, they were welcomed adepts. They lived side by side, the Aryans, or the local indigenous people on the Indus and Sarasvati River. The total lies have been told to us about the Aryan invasion, so-called, of India. They lived in Cappadocia. They lived in Turkey and Anatolia. And by the way, Anatolia, that's Turkey, is from a botanical point of view, from a geographical point of view, and from a from every point of view that you can imagine of science, is considered a Western country, by the way. Today, it's only certain prejudice that believes that everywhere east of the Balkans is east. As a matter of fact, Turkey, in almost all of its scientific senses, is considered to this day still a Western country. So the Scythian groups you see in these proto-Celtic groups, just to be very clear for people, again, because in Volume 1, in the introduction, I try to clear up the meaning of these terribly misused words like Celtic and Gaelic and what have you. Celtic is another one of the most misused terms. It was mostly used by Romans, and it just meant something like barbarian. Basically, anyone that the Romans hadn't conquered yet, or anyone whose religion they didn't understand, they just called it Celtic. So it's one of the most broadest and most useless terms you can imagine, and certainly had no application to the tribes themselves. They would not have used that term. There was only one term. There was only one tribe, I mean, and they were called the Keltoi, with a K, K-E-L-T-O-I, that perhaps used a term similar to that to define themselves. In every other instance, and I don't care if you're talking about Turkey or the Ukraine or Spain or even Ireland then later, you know. In fact, it's now been discovered, amazingly, that the Celts were a very late group into Ireland, and that the ancestral people of Ireland were absolutely 100% proven, even with DNA evidence, and talk about this in Volume 1, were not Celtic. Well, then the story arises, what were they, you see? Well, these were the megalithic people that is best called the Arya. And they took their name from their land, the land of the West, the land of the goddess Ari. And their elements were welcomed, not only because of the way they looked. And if people really find it hard to get their mind around this, then, you know, maybe they should go to the East. Because the appearance of tall, pale blonde men and women, with golden red hair or even blonde hair, and many in the ancient days those tribes used to dye their hair, or not dye, but they'd use lime to even further whiten their hair. The appearance of such people in the eastern lands was really something to behold, and that alone needs to be focused on. And whether they're called Dorians, you know, or Archaeans, again, the linguists and the various archaeologists working mostly for the Vatican over 100 years ago, they've done a right, you know, job of work to make sure we don't find these hidden connections of who these people are. But I'm glad to see that in modern days, a lot of evidence is now coming out practically by the month to confirm, you know, what I've been talking about and what my mentors like Commons Beaumont and Conor McDarry have been talking about. So the idea is that it's not a name of a race at all, but it certainly was the term that was used for a caste of elders, a caste of enlighteners. And they moved west approximately 13,500 years ago, not by choice, but because of the cataclysms that happened in the west, which were absolutely severe, very, very severe. These included tsunamis. These included enormous devastation of the earth, not in the uniformitarian way that, again, has been taught in the schools, but in this cataclysmic way. And evidence, again, is coming to light that Ireland was wrecked, as the north of Scotland, Argyllshire, certainly Norway. In fact, in Norwegian mythology and Norwegian history, they even know something about something that's called the Storega tsunami. Stor is a Scandinavian word meaning big or large. So the huge tsunami that took place just on the west coast of Norway in between Scotland. And that wrecked the land bridges that existed between northern Scotland and Scandinavia. So when we talk about the Arya, we're talking about the Proto-Teutons, and we're talking about a group called the Goths. And in Scandinavian languages, a G is often pronounced like a Y, so it's really the word get, is which meant goat, is pronounced like yet. And then this word group turns up in China. It turns up in northern India with a people called the Jats Sikhs, who is an agricultural elite, a warrior elite. In their physiognomy, you can tell that they're westernized. They themselves agree that they were westernized, that their ancestors were from the west or the northwest. And the terminology and the etymology confirms it too, that these Goths or Geths or what have you, the men of the goat, the people of the goat, you know, were a widespread college. There's phenomenal evidence of this. And the word Arya or Ari can be found in the words like aristocracy. You know, again, representing in its purest form that these people were a sort of an aristocracy. They were basically identical to the stellar cults of the ancient world.
Where does the symbol of the swastika originate?
That's from the movement of Ursa Minor. It's astrological again. Of course, it turned up in the Vedas with the Sarasvati and Agni. And it's horrific to me that, you know, you could be arrested today for having a tattoo of the swastika and they drag you into court and it turns out you're a follower of Agni or something. It's a totally religious symbol. It has nothing. But again, just like the term Aryan was abused, so were the symbols of the Arya.
Assert.
One of which, oh yeah. I mean, the Arya, I think, probably have to read my own book to remind myself, but I think, you know, it's just so much information, but I think there's even evidence that they used the double-headed eagle. They certainly used the swastika. You know, an argument could be made that a great deal of the iconography that's used in masonry today, just like we were talking about the letter G, you know, and of course that's picked up by the Gaonim, which is the elect group of so-called Jews. But that term's, and that's probably the second most abused term in the word Jew and Judite. And I often say in my work that don't people realize that the King and Queen of England, these potentates of the West, are Judites, even though they're from the Protestant religion, and the Pope in Rome is a Judite, even though he's of the Catholic religion. How do people understand that? Well, this again goes back to the origin of these terms. They do not represent what we think it is today. It's by a colossal mechanism of deception that all of these terms, even the terms Israelite, Jew, Judite, Levite is a term that directly takes you back to the yew tree, you know? Or is it the Rowan tree? Yeah, the Rowan tree. And there's other terms that are used, like Jew is a derivation of the yew tree. Because in ancient languages, first of all, the Hebrew never used vowels. And that made it difficult to translate certain terms, like Jehovah and Elohim. You had to insert the vowels, and of course, that was just a matter of an individual scholar's interpretation. So this explains a lot of anomalies when you start looking at language and words. But the most interesting thing is that the letters J, I, and Y were interchangeable. And this is why the word Yahweh and Jehovah, one has a Y and one has a J, even though they're speaking about the same deity or whatever. And there's even translations where they use the I. In fact, if you really go into the esoteric tradition, the first letter of Jehovah's name is an I, and that's because in Hebrew, the first letter is called Yod, right? Y-O-D or I-O-D. But right. Basically what it means is that Y, I, and J are interchangeable.
Well, it's just like Yugoslavia in Yugoslavia was spelled with a J. You know, it's not spelled with a Y. That's the English spelling.
Good point. I forgot about that one. And there's many other examples of this kind of thing going on.
Right. Yeah. And Serbo-Croatian and a lot of other languages, the letter J is pronounced Y. It's only in English, as far as I'm aware, that it's even pronounced J, which they pronounce as a DZ sound. J. Mm-hmm. DZ.
Yep. And then certainly in Norway and Sweden and what have you, they definitely pronounce it like a Y. It causes a lot of problems because there's G's everywhere and it never is pronounced like a G. It's always pronounced like the Y, you know. And this, of course, then leads you a little bit around to the truth, because the I, or in brackets, the Y and the J, is the first letter of the name of God, no less. But that letter is Gaelic. That letter stood for the yew tree. And the name of the yew tree, you know, was symbolized and involved the letter I. This is because the old Aryan language, the letters were always connected to trees. In fact, the earliest writing was on leaves. That's why we still use the term leaves when we talk about a leaf of a book. And the Druids, in order to communicate secretly, especially in their mystery schools, would tie different bunches of leaves together on a string. And then the messenger would carry that message, which is just a bunch of leaves, just pretty much like the Ogham alphabet, but only a leaf version. So all language, all these letters, goes back to the Celts and the Druids and the Gaels. And then I was going to define those terms for us. The Celtic is, again, one of the most bastardized terms. Gaelic is a little bit more legitimate. It means the white ones or the bright ones. Gaul, like Galway or Bengal or whatever. And the Gaels are a group of Scythians that invaded into Ireland. They're also known as the Milesians. All history books and official history books say it happened between 500 and 600 BC. I say it happened about 1,000 years before that, not too long after the demise of Akhenaten in Egypt. And that's what I go into in Volume 2. So the Gaels is a little bit more of a legitimate term that was used by they themselves. And this is where we get the word Gaelic, especially when they're talking about the language of the Gaels and what have you. But the language of the Gaels and most of their religious traditions were based on the Arya, who are much more earlier. These are the original megalithic inhabitants. Now, we're not supposed to know about them in exactly the same way that we're not meant to believe that an Atlantis existed in the West. So the whole story of the tabooness, you see, of even believing that civilization could be in the West, is part of the propaganda of the world. And when you know the true story, then it turns all that we know about history on its head. As I say, I repeat, that doesn't mean that I don't believe that there was high cultures in the East, nor do I not say that there was migrations from the East to the West. There absolutely were. And that includes the work of L.A. Waddell. It includes a lot of even some elements of British Israelite philosophy, who are always adamant that there was Western transition, you see, of certain holy prophets. For instance, Joseph of Arimathea and Prophet Jeremiah and Tia Tefi. There's a whole school within the comes under the umbrella of the British Israelite philosophy who talk about these migrations. And I'm open to that. But those were in much, much, much more recent times in the sense of history. So my work, again, is focusing a little bit earlier times, but it doesn't negate the fact. But what I do is I say that those migrations were most, for the most part, returns, the returns of descendants who couldn't go back west because the lands were in such a, you know, decayed and state of affairs. So these, you know, even Ralph Ellis's latest book, in fact, his whole saga of the story of Jesus also fits under, he's not a British Israelite, obviously, but it fits under the category, the umbrella of that, because he again is talking about his Jesus, the man he's identified as Jesus, which is Jesus of Gamala. The saga ends in England. The saga is of even his character comes to Britain. And of course, immediately that sparks people's interest who've studied this, go, oh, that's what the British Israelites always contended, you see. And that's even what the bloodline storybooks, like the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, the whole Merovingian saga also insists that, you know, the story of Mary coming to southern France, blah, 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 ending up in Wales. So Ellis has now concurs with all of this. But again, late. From Michael Tesorian's point of view, those are all very fascinating. But those are tremendously late phenomena in history. And I can even answer why they came there. Why would Britain be the home of the first pharaoh? In fact, not the home, but the grave of the first pharaoh of the first dynasty, King Menes, is up at Knockmany in Northern Ireland, you know, or Tia Teffy, or, say, Mira Tatton, Scota. All of these different dignitaries that have been discovered that coming from the east in Egypt, or the prophet Jeremiah, the British Israelites are always going on about it, and Arimathea, now even Jesus of Gamala. You know, all of these individual scholars give you their reasons why they came to England. Ralph Ellis will tell you his Jesus came there because he was sent there to be imprisoned, like some sort of man in the iron mask palava, in which the Roman Caesars wanted Jesus of Gamala out of the way. So they basically sent him to a penal colony, like some sort of Napoleon, you know, on the island of Elba, right? Another British Israelite will tell you, oh no, Joseph of Arimathea came over to England, of course, because they were tin miners and copper miners. They were merchants, and that's what they were interested in. Another guy will tell you this and this and this and this. And all along, they're forgetting one of the most fundamental things, is they came there because their ancestors, came from there thousands of years before. And most importantly, their ancestors always knew that the lands of the West were the ancestral fountainhead of all knowledge and all wisdom. Of course they were going back there. Of course the first pharaoh of the first dynasty, he wanted to take a trip towards the end of his life and go over to Ireland, not because he had nothing better to do. It's because their own ancestors, the Shemsu Hor, you see, the founders of their own culture, their kindred brothers, came from those shores. This is the big lie. This is the big fact that, you know, has been rewritten, and it's the truth that needs to be understood. That's the core reason why, you know, the Morris Cotterells will discover that you know, the chalice of the Grail has an Irish tie-in, and that it might even in fact be the identical to the Arda chalice. It's why, for instance, I will point out that Herne the Hunter, the stag god, was wearing the original crown of thorns that you see then turning up in the Bible as the crown of thorns, or Moses' horns, you see, and all of the different anecdotes that I go into. That has to be borne in mind fundamentally. And this group that then was the keepers of knowledge, the keepers of the pre-diluvian knowledge, because before the fall of Atlantis, there was the great knowledge. And when it was destroyed, the islands was destroyed, the pre-diluvian continents was wiped out, that knowledge, that gnosis, was carried to the shores of Britain. And it was in literally the Druids, their very term Druid means the keepers of wisdom, the keepers of knowledge. They were the adepts who, in one shape or another, through music and through other forms, tried to maintain, also through language, tried to keep these secrets. And so when we see these bastions of power today, whether it's masonry or the church, that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a deeply plagiarized and deeply corrupted form of the original mystery school teachings of these things. And that is exactly the reason, then, if we fast forward, why it is that these architects of power are lethally afraid of the average man in the street even dabbling in certain things like astrology and divination. And even more so, we get backlashes for even dealing with astrotheology. You know, my book on that and other researchers like yourself, you put your astrotheology in the title and that's it. You're going to be pilloried, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, people like Jordan Maxwell running around having aneurysms, you know, wondering all the attacks that they've been given for what? You know, and because, again, there is that fear of the actual knowledge itself, but it's coming as a trickle-down effect. It's coming because they're lethally afraid that their workings of the machinery that they've hidden for so long will suddenly be revealed and there might be a return. Don't forget, we're talking about people who financed worldwide genocide. And I don't care if it's the Gnostics or the Zadokites or the Essenes or the Mandeans or the Stoics, these people are the witches, the Wicca. They have literally wiped out many organizations or churches that tried to rise because they looked like they were returning to a sort of a pan-Druidic, maybe not in a really pure way or anything, but 50-50. So groups like the Cathars or the Bogomils, you know, there's a lot of evidence there that they were even trying to return. Because actually even the geographical placement of some of these Gnostic groups was on sites like Languedoc in France and other places, which were early, early, early Druidic sites. So even the location of these people tends to give credence to this. But I have no doubt in my mind especially if you study Stoicism. The Stoics were almost identical to the Druids. And the Essene, there's many elements within the Essene groups and the Gnostic groups that also, you know, have a smack, they smack a little bit of Druidism. They were immediately wiped out, and I think it's for that reason. And this kind of campaign goes on to the modern day. They've supplanted their own New Age palava, which is just bogus nonsense, because again, they were afraid that if Theosophy and some of these other religions, these other little cults or sects, we might want to call them, maybe it could happen that those druidic elements, again, could start manifesting. So they put their agents in there to completely co-opt it, and then we have their own brand of it, you know, which is just utterly ridiculous, you know?
I do. All right. You want to talk about the Oval Office?
Right. The Oval... This is really amazing. I mean, of course, people, as I said, are up to speed a bit on the idea of Washington in general and Philadelphia and what have you. But the Oval Office, again, being the central hub, it's always been pointed out that there's symbolism connected there. I start with that on the Tree of Life page. I start with those pictures and a little bit of a preview, and then at the end of the piece, I review it. Why the circle? An oval is just basically a circle. Why a circle? Why the stars in it? Why the floral motifs? We go into a big exploration of that. And then conclude by showing that just the fact of the circle, in fact, just the fact of the circle around the pyramid. Everyone notices the pyramid. They don't notice the circle around it. They go over to look at the eagle on the dollar bill, right? What's around it? A ring. A circle. The Oval Office is a circle. The St. Peter's Square, you know, what have you. Always outside the Masonic buildings, you have the symbol of the circle. And this circuit, this circle, does not just represent the sun, because the sun is often shown inside the circle. So obviously the circle itself can't be the sun. The circle, it represents that circumpolar region, is basically what it is. This is another piece that people need to really be aware of. The word White House comes from an Egyptian term, Perhetch, which meant White House. And it was one of the governmental offices in Egypt, in Memphis, actually. So then inside the White House, you have this thing called the... Red Room, or the cross hall, it's actually called, which is like a big red cross, you know, the typical British symbolism again of the British flag. And you can see the British flag emblem when you take a overhead view of St. Peter's Square. Not only is it shaped like a Templar thistle, but it has the sort of British coat of arms, or, you know, in St. Peter's Square, all this Merovingian connection. Then you even have the whistleblowing movies. I think it was National Treasure, wasn't it? Number 2, in which the hero, or the protagonist, gets inside the Oval Office and then sort of almost... He had actually discovered that the desk, the president's desk, is a twin, get this, twin of a desk that's in Buckingham Palace as used by Queen Victoria and the monarchs of Britain. If that isn't one of the most whistleblowing, you know, sort of red flags, that wait a minute, the desk that the... And I don't even really know if this is true yet. I'd like to find out whether, in fact, this is, in fact, something that the movie introduced, or it's actually true, or it's meant to allude to something even more secret. But the very fact that the desk in the White House, I mean, I never stopped asking people this question. Who, you know, in America, I keep asking Americans, especially in light of what's been taking place recently with the economy and the swine flu and what have you, who is your enemy? You know, because we now have the rise of the Islamists and the jihadists and all, and that's all very legitimate and needs to be studied. But my God, in the middle of all of that flurry, who is your enemy? Who was your enemy? Who could possibly be doing this for you? Who are you welcoming to dinner that you don't remember 200 years ago who was your enemy? That America could be so goddamn amnesiac that they could forget that the British crown, that William III, I mean George III, swore eternal war. He swore eternal war, and his ministers take his wish, his word as a law, a commandment. His very wish is a commandment. And people who study the federal system and so on. So when you look at the design of Washington, D.C., when you look at these anecdotes, the movie, even National Treasure, brings out that there was a correspondence between General Pike, Albert Pike, right, of the
right
Scottish Rite Freemasonry.
Author of Morals and Dogma.
Yeah. The movie insists... An incredible anecdote there, that he was corresponding with none other, what was it, Queen Victoria. My goodness, what a whistleblowing fact. And people will accept it from a movie, a couple of lines of a movie, but people like us could write 10 books on it and they never believe it. There's scholars who've gone to incredible lengths to point the connections out. Who is your enemy? Never, no matter what other hydra comes up in front of you, for God's sake, don't. Who is really funding the federal system and the presidents and so on? So the physical connections, the geopolitical and political is connected to Britain, of course, and the symbolism proves it. But the symbolism goes through that, because these individuals, the Tudors, the teachers, the Plantagenets, the Windsors, all of these characters, they're Merovingian, they're Templar. And they are the ones who have co-opted the symbolism. America needs to hear this very clearly, because they're bashing the symbolism, as if the symbolism is Luciferian, dark, sinister, whatever. And you're getting a lot of this in even these shows and PBS broadcasts and big blockbuster movies, Dark Side of Freemasonry, this, Dark Side of Masonry, that, Secret Architecture, this, Secret Architecture, that. People come away thinking the architecture itself is in some way demonic or whatever. This is, again, hugely wrong. It's a tremendous travesty to come away thinking that. It is not. That wisdom, that gnosis, and those symbol, that iconography, comes from a much, much more sacred archive or canon.
Exactly.
But it has been corrupted and plagiarized by these organizations. So these two dots need to be connected. Otherwise, this whole story won't make sense. But the fact of these laurel leaves or olive leaves that we find all over it, that's held by the American eagle, the olive leaves and arrows being almost identical to the symbol of the tribe of Judah. If people go to this page, they'll see an emblem of the tribe of Judah. And I want them to compare that to the symbol for the United Nations, for instance. Not only the colors, but the very design. Anyone with even a modicum of understanding can see that they're based on the same idea. Then there's Masonic aprons that use these leaves of olives. Very high potentates within Masonry. But then in the secular world, and on the uniforms of the military, and the coat of arms of the House of Rothschild, there's all of this floral motif. It's been used by the kings. It's been used by the priests and the potentates. It's certainly used by Masonry. They have their famous three columns, of course. And columns, just by the ribs on the columns themselves, will tell you that those were originally trees. They represent trees, and the little pilasters at the top of the columns, Doric, Ionic, and Corinthian, these scrolls and little floral motifs you see that people look at and see and they never think about it, those have a meaning for, a reason for existing. They all represent something. In ancient days, all tribes, every tribe was their emblem was a tree. They always identified with a certain tree, like the oak or the yew or the ash or the elm or whatever. They always had a symbol, a tutelary symbol.
In your opinion, how do you go about freeing the public mind and educating the masses about all that's been going on behind the scenes here?
Well, of course, I've always believed that salvation and revelation can't take place without education. So the process isn't really that difficult. And in my personal life, I've never gone out to anyone, not even for an interview, not to promote anything. I find that it's much better when people of interest, I've always said my work isn't really for everybody, and it's not. And it's for those people who have been following these threads, who have a certain synergistic and eclectic approach to it, non-biased, of course. And they've also put a lot of this stuff together. And just like I, in the early stages, had to study like mad, to connect some of the more abstract dots. People are doing that more than ever right now. And I think the medium is good too, through the internet and what have you. And of course, I do other things as well. Like, the divination arts is important, because my interest in the occult is because, the power brokers are using it. We try to point this out in great detail in Architects of Control Program 1, and went into elaborate detail to show how mind control is used. Why do we do that? It's to show that the mind, the masters of the game, use this iconography and the symbolism, and they use this sort of astromancy on the human race. And therefore, you've got a choice. Either fight the establishment with the weapons it's provided, or do something different. Arm yourself up with the very weapons that they've used on us and our forefathers for millennium. You know, which is really a no-brainer, which one of those is going to work? And that's why I have zero tolerance for those people who can't get with that understanding and who just, like, you know, just like I say, every time they open their mouth, they subtract from the sum of human knowledge. There are such people in the world, and we have to not listen to them.
Very true. And what do you say to people who criticize you for selling or providing tarot and psychic readings?
Nothing. I never engage with them at all. And remember, a lot of the people who are opposed to what I do and all have the perfect right to say and do what they want. If they want to show the world that they're idiots, go ahead. I give them the perfect right to do that. Why should I stop them? Time will always be on the side of the person who's got the knowledge and the truth. See, we've encountered something interesting. I have done in my work a long time. And I've realized that just the very fact that you bring up psychology, let's just look at this for a minute. You will automatically, and this has happened for, you know, nearly two decades or more, you will immediately be criticized as being dark, foreboding, and negative. And when you really finally step back and wonder why certain people say this, it actually turns out it's because you actually have the audacity to bring up psychology. That's what makes you dark, foreboding, and negative. It's really fascinating. And you know, there's nothing you can do about that. I'm not going to change my spots. I'm not, you know, I have a forte. I have a calling, and I know what I'm doing, and I need to just continue doing that without worrying about all the criticism.
And so you don't think that somebody who criticizes you for wearing your sunglasses on interviews and shows and on your website, that's a valid reason?
Jesus, do they do that? I had no idea. Is that what they've been doing?
That was a comment that I got from somebody recently that I was rather shocked about, yes.
My God. No, I have a very, very strong sensitivity to light. I can take it if I have to, but my eyes have always been very light sensitive. You know, and I find it very difficult to go out. I'm also extremely heat sensitive. I can't bear hot weather. I hate hot climates and hot weather. And it's also the sunlight. I don't know what it is. It's a melatonin thing probably. But well, somebody told me that because my ancestors were from Norway, it's something that they have a problem with. And I can really see the truth of that because it's really, you know how people, they do know, people are mostly up to speed on diet now. They know that certain foods don't agree with people. They know that certain environments don't agree with certain people. I don't know if many people have looked into the whole question of temperature, that there can be people who are actually temperature sensitive, and I am. It very much fits. And with that comes a certain light sensitivity. I mean, it's not a major thing or anything, but that's the only reason why I wear sunglasses like as much as I can, is because it's painful. But my God, I mean, it doesn't surprise me that there's people. And you know what it really boils down to is this. I have a great antipathy to people who worry about me and what my thought processes is and, you know, what kind of, you know, food I eat and the friends I hang around with and my personal life. It's irrelevant. The only people I'm interested in dealing with are those who are interested in my work and who keep the focus on that, both either critically or they're, you know, they like it or whatever. That's perfectly legit. And that's my professional work and my public sort of, you know, persona, what have you. Any other type of, you know, interest, and you can spot it right away, of course. Partly it's legitimate, but really I have no tolerance for it. It's not important who I am. It's not important how I got to, you know, the conclusions or what I've done. You know, these things are irrelevant. It's not something that ever interests me, and I kind of have to keep that separate. I've created so much work that I believe, really, I really almost demand it, that the attention of the people, you know, that come to me are not coming to me as to find out who I am, where I'm from, who my family was, and all that rubbish. It's so irrelevant, you know. I mean, I'm not writing biographies of me. That's not my interest. The interest is this fascinating study, and that's when I believe where the passion and the focus should be focused. So it's, and then when people are not doing that, then you come up with all of this preposterous, you know, is he or isn't he, will he or won't he, you know, kind of back and forth. It's really irrelevant to what's going on. I guess I've always said to my closest friends that I think a lot of people would love to exchange their role with me because they, you know, would like all of that limelight and what have you, because I actually don't like it. It's not something that was planned, and it's really something I've had to do. It was very much the work of other people, including Jordan Maxwell and others, sort of coaxing me and pushing me out into the the forefront. You know, it's not something that I ever planned anywhere through my life at all. So I guess other people would probably want, feel good about exchanging places with me. They can enjoy all of that. But it's irrelevant to me completely.
What is the single most important concept that you would like people to take away from this interview?
Well, I would say that, again, without, you can't have revelation without education. And you have a lie mechanism operating in the world. And so I would say that basically there are no shortcuts. The basic message is that you have to get your arms around as much of this information as you can. You'll do yourself a favor by being unbiased in that process, and to sift it like a, you know, a gold miner sifts the gold and the sand to get those sparkling jewels, and make it your own. Enter into a relationship with knowledge in the very same way that you enter into relationships with people. Knowledge is a living, vital thing. It's not about gaining it in some acquisitive, egoistic way. It's about diving in there and becoming into almost a very visceral relationship with knowledge. That's what it's really all about. That's what makes a person. That's basically the step that initiates you onto the road of this great journey of awareness and enlightenment. And that will, of course, mean that that might mean leaving the consensus trance. The Siddhartha road is not easy to walk on, of course. A lot of people go a few steps and then they run right back into the consensus trance and the hive mentality. But those who've entered into a deep relationship will be guided. So, and one of the most important things also is to never, ever come to this knowledge with fear. In fact, don't have fear as the in any aspect of your life. I don't care what it is. Never operate in life through fear. Always operate through love and through, you know, passion. And keep the focus on the information and the knowledge, and not on the private details of the individual. This is where the messenger is not really as important as the message. There's sometimes when that rule can be broken, but in the general consensus, it's the most important to focus on the knowledge. And make it your own. Take it, make it your own, and work with it, and it'll come alive if you have a relationship with it. Otherwise, it's just a dead thing. And then you're no better than the average academic who's just jumping through hoops, you know, with a target on the a degree on the front of his chest and a target on the back. And if people are ever interested in my motive, my main motive, I've said it before, I'll say it again, is to honor the teachers of the past. You know, I have even specific teachers that I've introduced to my audience through my work. That is basically my motive, you know, is to never let their graves be, you know, unattended, and to make sure that their great work doesn't, you know, die and be forgotten.
Well said. Would you like to give out your websites and any other contact information?
Yeah. The latest work, of course, is Architects of Control. You can just go to architectsofcontrol.com. They can use michaeltessarian.com as a navigation page to all my websites and work, including the forum. We've got some great pages on the forum. And this particular interview is based on the Trees of Life. It's an appendices to the Irish Origins of Civilization. So you can just go to irishoriginsofcivilization.com, click on the appendices pages, and you'll see the appendices we have there. This one is appendices number 8. And Irish Origins of Civilization is also a link from the Michael Tessarian website. So if people just want to use michaeltessarian.com as the navigation page, they can see the astrotheology websites and the other 8 or 9 websites I've got there. They can use that and read through that, because it's really connects a lot of dots for people. I've had some very positive feedback over this Trees of Life, you know, thesis. And I, again, just want to thank you also for the, you know, the opportunity to share it. It's the first interview of in depth that we've done on it. It's really great to do that.
And thank you for coming on. And this concludes Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast. Actually, I don't know the number that this one will be, probably about 55. Michael, thank you so much for coming on and for sharing your research. And maybe we can do it again sometime soon.
I'd love to, yeah. This is always ongoing, of course. And look forward to that, Jan. Thank you very much.